pharmacist said, do you drink this juice? I said, yeah, that's it. He said, bounce across between a tangerine and a grapefruit.
Call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It is 5 p.m. And it is the 3rd of February. We have a really full agenda tonight. We will probably not get through it all. I will lay out the order that we're going to go in here. I know people have come from some considerable distance in some cases to be here to talk about one of the bills that we have up before us. We are going to be starting with a wrap-up, which will take a while from the bill that we started on yesterday, which is Senate Bill 1574. Prior to that, we will be taking a brief testimony from Senator Hansel on Senate Bill 1529, and then he has another obligation that he needs to get to. We will then be going back to Senate Bill 1574. I am guessing that that will take upwards of an hour. And then we will be getting into Senate Bill 1517, and we will work through that tonight. I'm guessing that it's possible that we won't get to Senate Bill 1529 tonight. So if you're here for that, we'll let you know as soon as we know. I mean, it's a pretty full room, so I think it's going to take some time to get through the other two bills. So that one will probably be put back. But Senator Hansel will at least start off with his testimony. So we're going to start out by opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1529. Senator Hansel, if you'll kick us off. And then next up, we'll be opening up the public hearing on Senate Bill 1574. And the first panel will be the utilities, Scott Bolton, Varner Seaman, and Gary Bauer. So you guys could be getting ready. Senator Hansel, you're up.
Thank you, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Hansel, State Senator for District 29. It includes the people of Wallowa, Union, Umatilla, Morrill, Gillum, Sherman, and half of Wasco counties. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 1529 and the Dash 1 amendments. I've been working closely with the League of Oregon Cities and Special Districts Association of Oregon to get this bill put together. This bill is fairly straightforward. It states that for people living within a homeowners association do not need to water their lawns if and only if one of three triggers is met. These triggers are: the governor declares that a severe drought exists or likely to exist. The Water Resources Commission, secondly, states a severe or continuing drought exists or is likely to occur. Or three, a governing body of a political subdivision within a planned community requires conservation or containment of water use. We were approached by Gene Grant with the condo/HOA working group to seek an amendment to add language to the bill that this is a temporary act only while any of the triggers are in effect. This was, in fact, the intent of the bill, and as such, I was more than willing to have the Dash 1 amendments drafted. I am very supportive of the Dash 1 amendments. Thank you very much, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions.
Handled like a pro.
You're going.
Any questions for the senator?
Thank you for your courtesy.
All right.
To let
Thank
me
you.
Thanks.
Pretty straightforward. Thank you very much. Now we will be... We will be turning to Senate Bill 1574, so we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1574. And if the panel that I previously mentioned, Gary, Varner, and Scott, if you could come forward. Next up, after these gentlemen, will be the PUC. These next two panels were invited testimony, so they're going to have a little bit more time than the general public because they have technical details that are part and parcel to the policy, and a lot more knowledge that we need to understand as part of this bill. After these next two panels, we will be moving to timed testimony. And we'll just be taking testimony from people that were here yesterday and had signed up, since this is just a continuation of that hearing. So, all right, you guys are up.
Deals.
Oh,
we're gonna do them all.
Sorry about that. I forgot to mention, as per yesterday, the vice chair will be requesting that we swear some of the panelists in on this bill. I don't know about other bills, but on this particular bill. And so I would like to make sure that everybody understands what their rights are before we proceed with that. So,
Mr. Chair, I thought it was all or none. Are we swearing people in selectively?
It is his discretion. So we could swear everybody in, but we did not swear everybody in yesterday.
Each panel that comes
just
up.
Just the invited panels.
So.
That's what I heard.
No, it's just every panel that comes up.
The panels. Even
Every panel on this bill today will be sworn.
Yeah, when you say panel, are we talking about the individual people testifying as individual public citizens?
Yes. Well, each of them will
yes,
be.
Yes, I will call. I call that a panel. The whoever the three chairs are filled, every one of them.
Okay, because we didn't do that yesterday.
That's right.
We
did one. We did one
all day long, except for the evening to expedite the process. But today, I'd like to see it done.
Gotcha.
Okay.
All right.
Let's move on. So for everybody that hasn't heard this prior, Oregon's legislature is one of the most open and inclusive in the nation. We hold public hearings on each of our bills and seek input from the public in our committee process. We depend on the information provided to us by the citizens of Oregon. No one can tell us better how the laws we pass affect the people of our state. All we expect in return for your help is that you respect the members of this committee, respect the legislative process, and that you tell us the truth. Whether you are another member of the Legislative Assembly, the director of an agency, a lobbyist, or a member of the general public, we expect for your testimony to be truthful. However, I am concerned that the practice of swearing in witnesses will have a chilling effect on the willingness of everyday Oregonians to participate in the process of making their laws. For that reason, I want to address those of you planning on coming before this committee today. The vice co-chair of the committee is within his rights to swear you in. However, you have rights too. You do not have to swear an oath. You can walk away if you choose. You can choose to have an attorney present with you. You can avail yourself of your Fifth Amendment rights, including the right not to give testimony against yourself. And if you tell the truth, nothing you say to this committee, whether you have sworn an oath or not, can be used against you in any state proceeding. You should know, however, that this immunity does not extend to any federal legal proceeding that may be brought against you, including a federal criminal proceeding. If you testify under oath and do not tell the truth, you could be charged with the crime of perjury. Perjury is a Class C felony and carries a maximum possible sentence of 5 years imprisonment, a $125,000 fine, or both. It is up to the Marion County District Attorney, however, whether to proceed with any charges for perjury. So if you don't feel too chilly at this point and wish to proceed.
Can we please raise your right hand? Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you're about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
You gotta get that oath changed.
All right.
Should be on. They can affirm too.
Yeah. Senator Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman. I'm here tonight representing Portland General Electric. I wanted to have a chance to talk a little bit about our perspective on Senate Bill 1574 and talk about carbon emission issues in particular. First off, Portland General Electric has, we believe, pretty solid track record of taking actions and of supporting policy to reduce the emissions associated with generating electricity on our system. PGE has supported the renewable portfolio standard. We have worked with the emissions performance standard, which prohibits us from acquiring new baseload coal resources or acquiring an ownership interest in coal resources. We have supported the public purpose charge since 1999, enacted in Senate Bill 1149. We've supported money collected through the public purpose charge that goes towards low-income bill payment assistance, weatherization programs, and energy efficiency programs that are administered through the Energy Trust of Oregon. We also are, when we build new fossil generation plants, we pay into the Climate Trust, which has money that goes to fund offset programs to offset the emissions from those newly constructed fossil generation plants. We have nationally, over the last several years, at the federal level, we have lobbied in support of cap and trade policies that would exist at a federal level and encompass all states. More recently, we have worked collaboratively with both state and federal agencies on the implementation of the Federal Clean Power Plan, also referred to as Section 111D of the U.S. Clean Air Act. With that said, we are today, I'm here testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 1574. We are supportive of a bill that's working its way through the House process, House Bill 4036, that we believe, based on our modeling and based on the modeling of the Global Warming Commission, Oregon's Global Warming Commission, we believe that the provisions of House Bill 4036 would put PGE on track to meet our pro rata share of Oregon's GHG reduction goals that exist in statute today. As we've testified on the House side yesterday morning, we believe we can do this at a pretty modest cost for customers of utility, for utility customers in our service territory. I want to talk a little bit about how we see the provisions of 1574 working and what the impact would be on our system. I think one of the things that I've heard from folks in this building is an expression that with the provisions of House Bill 4036, that Senate Bill 1574 would not have an impact on Portland General Electric. And so I wanted to just give a fairly simple understanding of how the allowance system and the auctions would work under the bill in front of you tonight, and then talk a little bit about how we see that impacting our system, just a technical description of it. So the first part, and I think that the way that the bill, as we read it, just taking plain language interpretation of it, the state would issue allowances for carbon emissions, and those would be given for free to different obligated entities under the bill. In our case, we would be given a set of allowances. We would then surrender those allowances into an auction, and the money that was paid out of the auction would go into a fund to offset the cost of rates under this bill. So that's the part on free allowances. In a separate transaction, we would need to go back to the auction, and we would need to pay for the allowances that we would need to retire so that we could be in compliance with the law. As we look at the bill as drafted and looking at what we project our emissions to be out from 2020 through 2030, taking a plain language of the bill and just looking at what we assume our emissions will be under House Bill 4036 and under the Federal Clean Power Plan, we did a fairly simple calculation of looking at a price per ton for allowances at $13, which we think is a proxy for where allowances are trading right now in the California market, roughly around $13 a ton. So we looked at that as a low case or as a base case. And then we also looked at the cost for PGE's system of allowances selling at $150 a ton. We use that as a reference case because in the PSU study on a carbon tax that was put out last year, PSU stated that at $150 a ton, we would not yet be meeting our GHG reduction goals through carbon pricing. So we use those as two proxy amounts. And for the year 2020, at $13, and again, we're using a fairly simple assumption of the bill as we see it, using those proxy amounts, what we model is our emissions, and just doing a simple calculation that way, we estimate that in the year 2020, the cost at $13 an allowance for us would be $98 million, a little over $98 million. The cost at $150 a ton for an allowance would be slightly above $1.1 billion for our system. We believe that we have a responsibility to reduce our emissions and that to spend customer dollars to get in compliance with the GHG reduction glide path that's in goal and statute we think is appropriate. That's one of the reasons why we support House Bill 4036. if this bill were to pass and to be under the declining cap that's anticipated in this bill, our belief is that we would need to take to engage in the actions that are anticipated under House Bill 4036, which is investing in all cost-effective energy efficiency, stopping the use of coal to generate electricity, and then largely replacing that coal with new renewable resources. We have concerns that if this bill were to pass, we would pay the cost for the allowances, and then we would also have to go forward with the emission reductions activities that are anticipated in House Bill 4036. So our concern about the bill that's in front of you today is that it doesn't necessarily cause the reduction in our system, reductions in emissions in our system, as we do in 4036, but it does add a significant amount of cost to our system in creating the program that's been outlined in the bill in front of you. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks and look forward to taking questions in a moment. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll do the whole panel before we take questions.
Okay. Mr. Chair, committee members, Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Power. Pacific Power is an electric utility serving Oregon. We have about 560,000 customers or so across the state. Pacific Power also serves retail load in California, so we do have some experience with the cap and trade program already as a load serving entity in that state. And we also serve customers in Washington. And then we have a sister business unit as part of Pacific Corp, Rocky Mountain Power, which serves customers in Utah, Wyoming, and Idaho. We are Oregon's largest rural electric provider, and Oregon comprises about 25% of that total load across that six-state system. First, I just want to say I appreciate the chair's hard work, and Senator Edwards, you and Senator Beyer, we know, have put a lot of effort into this. I believe it's very well-intentioned. I know through our conversations there's definitely an interest in trying to look out for the welfare and benefit of rural Oregon in particular.
Usually a statement like that is followed by but.
I got more
well-intentioned.
Yeah.
But. Sorry.
Yes, continue.
Just take credit where credit's due,
first.
Senator.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to appreciate in where you're trying to go with this, as well as I think you're recognizing what we're recognizing as well, is that there's growing public interest and sentiment around climate change policy and carbon reduction in general. And we see that through direct conversations with our customers as well as other stakeholders. I don't need to repeat a lot of what Varner said about how a cap-and-trade system works or its appropriateness for the electricity sector. I will simply echo that under the Federal Clean Power Plan, as states are starting to develop their implementation plans under the EPA's 111D rule, that we will very likely end up in a cap-and-trade system around existing power plants as it is. And that federal cap-and-trade system is, frankly, the most inclusive and comprehensive way to regulate emissions from the electricity sector rather than kind of an added-on state policy, which we think is costly and duplicative to what we're already going to experience, particularly since the large majority of Pacific Corp's generating units that would fall under this plan are outside the state of Oregon. We have only one fossil fuel power plant in the state of Oregon. That's the Hermiston gas plant. Everything else that we have within this jurisdiction is hydro or a qualifying renewable resource. And because of that, the premise of a cap-and-trade program or a new cost or retail fee or tax or however that ultimately gets determined of what this cost would be, is it would really be applied to retail customers. It doesn't accomplish the goal of carbon reduction by changing dispatch or changing how we operate the system. So our chief complaint with this approach to greenhouse gas reduction is that it places a cost on Oregon consumers, but to pass that cost up to apply it to generating units that are located out of state, we would effectively be placing that tax on retail customers and other states that have not adopted this policy. So we can't pass along Oregon's policy costs of public policy onto other states. And so we end up in a situation where there's just added cost to customers, but we're not actually achieving the emissions reductions that I think are intended behind this. As Varner testified, and I'll agree to, House Bill 4036, because of its increase in renewable energy resource acquisition and growing that portfolio, does result in actual emissions reduction that would be associated with a state policy. So we do believe that that is the most cost-effective place to go if you want to reduce actual emissions as a matter of a state policy goal. The other thing I just want to say really quick is because we do business in California, we have some experience with their cap and trade program. And this is maybe where there's a little bit of a butt in the setup. As Assembly Bill 32, which was that state's comprehensive economy-wide greenhouse gas program, was adopted, and it went through a very robust rulemaking process, we believe in a lot of ways that the design of the program seemed to at least capture that intent of what they were trying to do. As it's been further refined by the legislature in California, we have been disappointed in some of the results. And what I mean by that is that the best way, if you truly want to send a price signal to consumers, the best way to do it would be to do so on a volumetric basis. So the amount of carbon associated with that with that customer's usage of the electricity system, any revenue generated through an allowance system, and then repatriation of those revenues should be done on a volumetric basis. That's what the California Air Resources Board designed in their model rule down there in the regulation, and that's what we supported as far as the most effective way to make that program work. And before the program really got underway, the legislature did tweak that program, appropriated some of the dollars that were forecast to come into the allowance auction for other budgetary purposes, and then through that budget act also changed how the repatriation of those revenues went back to customers. So some customers receive a California climate credit. So twice a year we provide a credit back to customers based on the revenues that are gained through the auction process. That's very similar to what Varner described. Those customers are residential customers, small businesses, and energy-intensive, trade-dependent, or trade-sensitive businesses. I don't have the exact term. That's how I would describe it to the best of my knowledge. But those businesses or those customer classes would get credits. Those that are not targeted for credits don't. And so we do have within our retail customer base what I think is a real inequity, a real problem of cross-subsidization or cost-shifting that's happening within those customers. So I'll give you a good example. One of our largest customers in California is a forest products manufacturing company. They do not fit that trade-sensitive, energy-intensive, trade-sensitive, or trade-dependent definition that California adopted. That customer got an 11% rate increase out of the cap-and-trade program. A residential customer got about a 4% rate decrease out of the cap and trade program. No general change in cost of service was experienced. It was just a matter of kind of picking winners and losers within our customer base, and every California customer base is just by an act of the legislature. That is something that we're very concerned about as states look at these types of programs, that you do get into situations where there will be preferred customers over others. I'll also say that the other customer group or characteristic that wasn't picked out for preferential treatment is government. And so local governments, schools, state government institutions such as a major prison that we serve, those customers experienced effectively a higher cost than they would have had they also been designated as a recipient of the climate credit. So we're very concerned about the manipulation or the shifting around of revenues that are generated by these programs. We think that that's certainly a concern and something that, you know, needs great care if something like this were to be adopted. And then again, on a cost-effectiveness basis, we think that there are probably better ways to get at Oregon's carbon goals than this approach, which really isn't going to impact the generation costs of out-of-state generating units. So just kind of wrap up there and happy to take questions when we finish the panel. Thank you.
Thank you. Gary?
Thank you, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. I'm Gary Bauer, representing Northwest Natural. We appreciate the opportunity to appear this evening and comment. Quick background, Northwest Natural is a natural gas distribution utility. We're over 150 years old. We're actually Oregon's second oldest still operating business in the state. We serve over 700,000 customers. Approximately 89% of those are in Oregon and 11% of those are in Washington. As a natural gas utility, we primarily serve residential and commercial customers. Our residential customers comprise roughly 90%, commercial 9%, and industrial only 1%. And the reason for that is our industrial customers, particularly large industrial customers, can basically go out into the market and buy gas from marketers and others themselves. Now, they generally will pay us a transportation fee, but they're responsible for their gas. Natural gas touches nearly every segment of American life. It's extremely reliable. We don't suffer very often from an outage, and so as a result, that makes it very popular for particularly home heating and cooking, hot water, both in homes and businesses. It's also used by manufacturers. One of the benefits is natural gas is very low emissions of NOx, SOx, and fine particulate matter, no emissions of mercury, and approximately half the CO2 of coal. So we believe actually that natural gas can play a role in helping reduce greenhouse gas emissions in such areas as transportation, working with communities on emissions from wood stoves, community heating districts, combined heat and power. And while we support our electric brethren using natural gas, I will tell you that direct use of natural gas is much more efficient. No offense. Just a different perspective. Northwest Natural takes climate change very seriously, and we've taken a lot of steps to reduce our own greenhouse gas emissions and footprint. Those that are under our control, and I'll spend some more time on that. But these measures, just to kind of quickly run through those, as Varner mentioned, we also pay into the Climate Trust for our operations of our compressors at our Mist gas storage fields. We have approximately 100 hybrid trucks that run on compressed natural gas in our fleet. For safety and environmental reasons, we've worked to replace our piping system, and as a result, we've completely replaced all of our known cast iron and bare steel, and that results in a much tighter system. We've implemented a number of programs around how we operate. As the way we operate, we have trucks that have a lot of equipment and need to operate. We've completely changed our idling programs and are working to change out different types of equipment. We purchase 100% offsets of the CO2 associated with our own heating of natural gas. As another thing we've done, we participated with the Environmental Defense Fund on a study of methane emissions from natural gas distribution systems. On the customer side, we were the first standalone natural gas utility in the country to offer an offset for our customers where they can actually go out and buy an offset and offset the use of natural gas, and we do that in conjunction with the Climate Trust. Those programs have been investing primarily in the dairy arena in dealing with biodigesters. We also work, as the other utilities do, with the Energy Trust, community action agencies, and the Oregon Department of Energy on a number of appliance efficiencies, weatherization, and other products. I will tell you, though, that when it gets to the customer side and those measures generally often require the customer to put up some financial resources as well, which does create some limitations in how those play out over time. We are concerned about policies that unfairly penalize a state or a region and thus would prefer and support development of a policy at the federal level. I know, Senator Edwards, that you're frustrated with the fact that the federal government hasn't moved forward. While they have not moved forward on a climate tax, a carbon tax or a cap and trade, they are taking steps through their agencies to deal with various sectors, the 111D rules, there are rules in being formulated on the production of natural gas in the fields in those areas. So it's not a global approach, but they are working through a number of those. We share your concerns about climate, and we're concerned, however, that the bill as written may have some negative impacts on our customers. As the bill recognizes, I think, as you put in there, Senator, it does create some winners and losers, and I think that's why you've set up a number of funds to try to address that. I'll reference Mr. Finkley with the Northwest Industrial Gas Users was here yesterday. He is not back here today. But in his testimony, he raised a number of concerns about the impacts that the bill would have, particularly on business customers. We believe that any action to address greenhouse gases needs to be both good for the environment and the economy. And as a result, we favor policies that result in measurable reductions in greenhouse gases. Can I shift for a second? Unlike the electric utilities, where they're actually going out and looking at resources and then figuring out how they take that resource and turn it into electricity for their customers, we go out and we buy natural gas. The only thing we do to it is add mercaptan to make it stink. And then we sell that to our customers. So we don't change the product necessarily. We buy that. We pass it on at wholesale. It's not marked up. And so it definitely is just kind of a straight pass-through, and our customers then take that gas and use it however they see fit. Under Senate Bill 1574, it appears it would make us responsible for how our customers use natural gas. So again, we don't control the type of heating equipment they put in their homes. We don't control the kitchen appliances that your favorite restaurant uses, the boilers that a hospital uses or the state institutions use. And so figuring out how we address and become responsible for those uses becomes somewhat problematic. I won't go through the setup in the bill. I think Farner kind of walked you through how that would work. We do have a concern as you keep declining allowances for whatever our customers use. All those costs will somehow be collected and passed back on to our customers. And it's not clear exactly whether we get to buy offsets for 100% of that use. Our assumption, I think you've kind of pointed out, that those will decline. So we don't have the flexibility to address greenhouse gases as other businesses do. We are regulated by the Public Utility Commission. We need to go to the Public Utility Commission and basically have their approval for any of the programs we operate. Also, unlike the electric industry, the legislature has been developing policies for the last decade on how they should meet their customers' energy needs. At this point, there is one statute on the books that was just passed session before last that would allow utilities to start investing in some greenhouse gas programs. We currently have one program in front of the commission at this point. The docket is still pending. It's to allow us to invest in combined heat and power projects. I'll tell you, there's been a fair amount of pushback from various entities about us doing those types of programs. We're also interested in working with wastewater treatment plants. They get a lot of methane that comes off of those treatment plants. We'd be interested in capturing that gas and putting it into our system. We've had conversations with a number of the folks that we normally work with, our stakeholders. Again, some concerns about whether or not we should be in those types of businesses. So for us, the bill doesn't address any of the regulatory side of what a utility has to face, and we think that's a very important element that's missing. With that, I'll stop and answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you, each of you. Questions from members of the committee? Senator Olson?
Thank you. Werner, you've studied the bill very closely, I would imagine. Do you know if there's a differentiation between the biogenic emissions and the anthropogenic emissions in this bill, or if there is any?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I do not know. That's not something that I've looked at.
Okay. Follow up? Yeah. Just one last one. At your, let's just assume you use your $13 a ton. It was cost to you $98 million. Do you know how that would equate to the rates of the for the ratepayers?
Senator Edwards, or Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, to the best of my knowledge, we go through a rate setting process at the Public Utility Commission. As a rule of thumb, generally speaking, but not precise, but generally we use as a rough, that $19 million in cost is equivalent to 1% of rates, roughly speaking. So $98 million would be roughly about a 5% increase.
One follow-up question. And you collect funds, as you mentioned, for weatherization and all this stuff, and you give that money to ETO. Is that correct?
Senator Edwards, Senator Olson.
Actually, not weatherization.
No, the weatherization money goes to the community action agencies to administer, or actually goes to the Oregon Housing Community
Services. Housing Community Services.
Okay. Housing Community Services.
I apologize. Yeah. You have, there's a 3% charge on there for Energy Trust.
Yeah, the Chair Edwards, Senator Olson. Actually, Scott, do you want to? Scott,
sure.
Scott negotiated this legislation. I'll let him speak. To it. He's more.
Actually, I'm not that old. Senator Olson. The 3% public purpose charge. The majority of those dollars do go to fund energy trust programs. Those programs are split into energy efficiency programs and then a smaller renewable energy program as well. There's also a slice of that 3% public purpose charge, which goes to low-income weatherization programs, which are administered through the State Housing and Community Services Department.
The only point I'm trying to make is that if you add 5% to your rates, that's the 3% also is exacerbated, is pushed up, that it'll cost them more on that 3%. That's the point I'm trying to make, is that more money is going to go to ETO.
That could possibly be an outcome, that if the public purpose charge is based on gross retail revenue and that revenue is grown due to a new cost such as this, then you would probably expand that revenue base.
Thank you.
Senator Woodson.
Thank you. Actually, several questions. Mr. Bauer, the greenhouse gas emissions in the United States have fallen off dramatically in the last decade, last 15 years. Not so much due to the development of wind and solar, but due to the availability of cheap natural gas and the use of it, and it produces a lot less emissions than some other sources of energy. So wouldn't this bill, that's been driven by the free market, and wouldn't this bill tend to reverse that free market correction in greenhouse gas emissions by increasing your costs artificially?
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, I should probably start by saying I don't know, but a lot of the reduction has been natural gas replacing coal in the dispatching by the electric utilities, so that's, I think, been a primary source of that reduction. If you're increasing the price, basically, of natural gas, whether it's through a tax or by buying allowances, one would assume that drives the price up, and that probably does have an effect on the market. I'm not qualified to tell you how that would affect the market.
Thank you. Follow up.
Yeah, follow up.
Werner, in your model thing for 2020, is that an annual $98 million a year for the $13 a ton?
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, yes, and we did, again, just using $13 as a proxy.
It's not a cumulative, it's per year.
Yes. Per year, we did a modeling, just a simple, and it's a fairly simple calculation we did, and in reality it would be more dynamic than this, and we would
simple calculations in this arena are
we just did the straight per ton times emissions, what we anticipate our emissions to be under HB 4036 and the Clean Power Plan, and that is an annual number.
It's a work of art, but the question was, have you modeled that out for, say, 2030 and 2040?
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, we did the calculation for the year 2030. We've not done the calculation for 2040. The amount for 2030 at 13 a ton, we calculated to be $84 million at $13 a ton and $971 million at $150 a ton.
So it's pretty much consistent.
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, it declines. Our calculation has it declining because we show our emissions declining over time.
Okay. And one follow-up, Mr. Bolton. I'm particularly interested in Pacific Core since you supply most of my constituents, and do a good job of it.
Thank you.
Your My question is, have you done a cost analysis?
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, we have not.
Thank you.
Senator Denver.
Thanks. Gary, just going back to Senator Whitsitt's question, under this, the price of gas would go up, but presumably the price of coal would go up even more. No, I mean, this is based on carbon intensity. Isn't that how
Chair it, how Edwards, it Senator Denbro, yes.
I mean, you would still remain competitive.
I should probably let Scott answer that. He's
great.
Actually got a lot more coal in there.
Yeah, Senator Denbro, it's hard to see how this bill would put a price on coal resources that are out of state. So I reckon if this became in effect before the Boardman plant closure, it could impact the price of that fuel or specific to the fuel cost for that power plant because it's in Oregon. But the coal doesn't transit Oregon. It would be generated out of state. So it, at least in our experience, how this would really apply would really be through the retail consumer experience. So it would be a cost that would be applied based on generation conditions outside the state. And as I explained earlier, it's very difficult to take a state policy or a retail cost and push that upstream to where it would impact consumers in other states.
Yeah, I hear you. Thank you. Gary, is gas part of the program in California?
Chair Edwards,
how are they doing?
Chair Edwards, Senator Denbro, yes, that is my understanding. We have been communicating with the gas utilities down there. It's really early. They're able to still buy offsets or allowances, basically. It's really early in their program, so I can't tell you any more than that.
Has it been driving up the cost very much?
There are a number of things driving up the cost, so I believe that it's adding to their cost, yes.
But you don't know by how much.
I do not know how much.
Okay. That's something we might look at. Varner and Scott, I really appreciate the work that you've done with the other bill, the coal transition, renewable portfolio standards. I think, my sense at this point anyway is that it's really going to make a difference. I agree with you. Is it going to get us all the way to where we need to be to meet our goals? And if not, I mean, that's kind of what we're searching for here is what tools can we use to meet our climate goals for this state?
Chair Edwards, Senator Denbro, we believe it will. And, we're working in concert with the Oregon Global Warming Commission to make sure that we agree on a methodology that would measure that. But looking at our system today and where House Bill 4036 would take us with a hard target of coal service ending for Oregon after 2030, or frankly, by 2030, that gets us pretty far down the road. Now, it's hard to say what the electrical system and the grid is going to look like and what the resource supply mix will look like very far out there, but the preference that policy places on renewables effectively is the first resource addition that we would make as we replace these resources, I think puts us very clearly on that glide path. And I think that's from a state greenhouse gas emissions reduction goal standpoint, as far as we can see at this point with other policy options that are out there, that is probably the lowest cost, most direct effect way to get at the electricity sector goal.
Chair Edwards, Senator Denbro, just friendly amendment to what Scott was just saying. I think that, clearly the House Bill 4036 is for the electric, or for investor-owned utilities for the electrical sector. And does not address the manufacturing sector. It does have a relatively small piece in the bill to try to stimulate some investment in transportation electrification. And as we look at emissions in the state, transportation emissions are a challenge to get at. We have a belief that transportation electrification can play a pretty significant role going forward in reducing emissions from that sector, but there's quite a bit of work to be done there to get that sector on track.
Mr. Chair, Scott, just one quick question. How many acres are your Marengo 1 and 2 wind farms?
Senator Olson, I'm not sure. I can get back to you.
Would you please?
We have that information. Marengo 1 and Marengo 2, I believe, are around, I think both of those, these are wind projects on the Columbia River Plateau in southeastern Washington, and I think their total generating capacity is somewhere around 399 megawatts or so. They cover a lot of ground. And I'd be happy to provide you and the committee with the specs of those projects.
Thank you.
I just have one other question, and to either Varner or Scott or both. Your modeling shows that the cost would reduce over time, and that seems counterintuitive to a situation that's going to drive your fuel costs up. So I guess the question is, do your calculations assume that the taxpayer will continue to foot most of the bill of the development of the wind and solar?
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, I think what we're talking about is we look at emissions declining over time. That is really a product of the Federal Clean Power Plan and the EPA's emissions limits under the Clean Air Act Section 111D, that we know that there will be limits and a ratcheting down of the emissions associated with fossil fuel plants under that federal rule. So regardless of what happens here with Senate Bill 1574, we will see declining emissions as we meet compliance with that federal standard. So if the idea is that there would be a carbon tax or carbon price assigned to emissions, logically, if that tax were stable over the course of that portfolio, that cost and that revenue would go down as emissions go down. Now, because this would be a market-based system and it's not necessarily a fixed price like a tax, as allowances, the amount of allowances go down, that logically, presumably, the price of the allowances could go up. And so you could end up paying more over less emissions. So kind of your cost per ton can change quite a bit over time depending on that market dynamic and the amount of liquidity in that market, if that makes sense. So it's not static under this type of approach. But I can say on the emission side, I think I can speak for both companies in that we expect as power plant operators that fall under 111D that our emissions will go down as we comply with that rule.
I'm sure that's true, but that's not quite answer the question. I mean, the question was, in your modeling, did you assume that the cost of the acquisition of the wind and renewable resources would be primarily paid by the taxpayer as it currently is being paid, as opposed to being paid by your ratepayers?
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, our modeling encompasses the phase out of the, or assumes the phase out of the production tax credit for wind and the phase out of the investment tax credit for solar, as was spelled out in the tax extenders package that passed at the end of the 2015 congressional session. So our modeling assumes that phase out, which I'd have to get back to you on the exact years, but in a few years out, there's a ratcheting down of those and then eventual phase out. They're going to be gone in 2021.
Maybe we can talk more about it offline.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Chair Edwards, if you don't mind, I'd like to maybe respond to Senator Dembrough's kind of question earlier. For Northwest Natural, we'd prefer to have programs that we could either work directly with our customers to help them reduce their energy use, which thus takes down the amount of gas they burn and the greenhouse gas output from that, or other programs within other sectors to help, again, but to keep as much of our, if we're going to collect money from our customers, to keep as much of that money here in the state and using those programs, again, some of those might move from the utility sector to a transportation sector. Overall, I think it helps the health of the community, though. Thank you.
Thank you, all of you. I think what we're seeking is, I mean, obviously, with this bill, there's the RPS deal, which you guys have been working on over in the House, and we're trying to reach a good understanding about what gets us to our goals at the lowest cost to customers. And there appear to be differing points of view about that. You guys, obviously, as specialists, have a lot more technical knowledge about how your companies operate, so we appreciate that. And we appreciate that input. We also want to hear from your regulator and from their staff, so they're going to be up next. But I do need to check in with Senator Johnson. Senator Johnson, are you?
I'm fine, sir.
You're fine? Okay. Then we'll call up next the PUC, and we'll make this declaration at this point that the folks that are here for Senate Bill 1529 that Senator Hansel spoke on, we will be carrying that bill over, and we will not be getting that to that tonight because this is going to take a while. So we will not be getting to Senate Bill 1529. It will be carried over, so if you're here for that bill, feel free to leave if you want. So, or you can stay here and listen to this riveting testimony. I didn't mean you.
No, I know.
Specifically, I meant the bill. My apologies.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, I'm Jason Eisdorfer, Program Director at the Public Utility Commission, and my intention and my hope is not to.
Hold on, just a minute.
Yes.
We want to.
Want to be fair.
Will you please raise your right hand? Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear or affirm that the evidence you are about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, I'm Jason Eisdorfer, Program Director of the Public Utility Commission, and my I intend to take much less time than the previous panel took. My goal here really is to serve as a resource, identify the parts of the bill where the Public Utility Commission is mentioned, and then maybe identify a couple of a few observations on the previous panel and some of the points they made. As you heard yesterday, the Department of Environmental Quality is really the front and center of this bill. There's really only two mentions of the Public Utility Commission. One is when the Department of Environmental Quality has to consult with a variety of agencies. The Public Utility Commission is one of them. I will say that I think we've come before you in the past to talk about the Clean Power Plan, where the DEQ, the PUC, and Department of Energy have been working together to work through, first of all, what the Clean Power Plan meant in general, what it meant for the state, and then ultimately how the state is going to comply. And so in terms of DEQ consulting with the Public Utility Commission, we really I don't foresee any problems. I think we're doing very well with regard to the current discussions and collaborations on the Clean Power Plan. The other place in which the Public Utility Commission is specifically mentioned is page 8 at section 12. It is the role that the Public Utility Commission has in making sure that revenues from allowances that were consigned to the auction and then come back to the utility are then redistributed according to the three main elements, the three main recipients set out in Section 12. You know, we're still running through this bill ourselves, trying to understand all of it and trying to understand what that would mean for the commission itself. At first blush, this doesn't seem like a huge burden on the Public Utility Commission. This seems like like an additional chapter to an integrated resource plan kind of thing, where the utility takes the revenues and plans the reallocation or the auction proceeds and how they're used, and the commission will oversee the allocation at that point. So a couple of points I think I'll make in response to the previous panel. As we understand it, and I this is my understanding, the way this law is constructed with regard to the investor-owned electric and gas plants, gas utilities, pardon me, is that those utilities will be allocated allowances commensurate with their emissions. Those allowances will then be surrendered back to the market operator, and the reason for that, and it's, I think the same reason that was identified in California, is to make sure that there is a liquid market in allowances, and so ultimately the market then has the allowances that were given to the utilities given back to the market. Those are then auctioned off. It is true that the utilities would have to spend a fair amount of money to essentially buy back those allowances. But ultimately, the revenue that was raised by selling those allowances comes back to the utility. And that is those are the proceeds, ultimately, that the commission is going to oversee allocating back largely to customers of the utilities. So the entire cost of buying those allowances on the part of the utility will not be borne by ratepayers. Quite the opposite, that ratepayers, as set out in the bill, those three directives, will see the revenue benefit from that. One of the key aspects of this bill is going to be creating a price signal to customers. So it is more than likely that as that revenue is returned to customers, it will be done not through rates, but on a based on cost, but not on a rate basis, because that would remove the price signal. A couple of other points, and then I'll happily answer any questions that you might have. I think the previous panel mentioned that the Clean Power Plan is likely to result in I think they said it's a form of cap and trade. That's one way of saying it. I think the other way of saying it is an allowance market. I think it's important to know that the Clean Power Plan will apply only to the electric sector. And I think one of the intents of this bill, as I understand it, is to begin to create a Pigouvian tax, internalize the cost of an externality across the entire economy, and therefore this would go beyond the electric sector. It would begin to link up the transportation sector and the electricity sector. And I think some of the most efficient, it's basically a market-based mechanism, and some of the more efficient carbon reduction opportunities may actually come through the operation by linking up the transportation and the electricity sector. So rather than have the electricity sector make a bunch of investments that may or may not be the most efficient investments to reduce carbon, by linking up transportation and electricity, you basically allow the market to identify what the most efficient and effective carbon reduction opportunities are. So I think in that way, this does differ from 4036. And so I think, as Chair Edwards said, there's sort of different theories and different preferences. So with that, I would just open it up to questions.
Thank you, Jason. Senator Woodson.
Thank you. Jason, I have here a legislative revenue report, estimated cost impact of cap and trade, Senate Bill 1574. This sheet shows that for PGE and PacifiCorp, the combined cost would be running in about $1.4 billion a year at $150 a ton. So what effect would that have? I mean, I'm assuming that the the investor-owned utilities would not be absorbing that cost. It would be passed on to the ratepayers. So could you give us an idea of what that would mean to the ratepayers?
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitson, again, as I understand the construct of the bill, that would be the initial cost. That would be ratepayers would, in a sense, pay to purchase the allowances. But the revenue gained through the purchase of the allowances would flow back to the utilities themselves to then redistribute as it's described in Section 12. And that is for bill assistance for low-income residential customers, bill assistance for energy-intensive industrial customers, or residential and small business customers. And so there would be that initial cost, but then most or a lot of that revenue comes back to the utility. And so it's not...
I appreciate that, Jason. Yeah. But the we're redistributing wealth here. I mean, if... I'm not going to, my meters aren't going to be receiving the largesse of the distribution of the allowance sale. What's it going to cost me?
Chair Edwards, Senator, why wouldn't you receive that? If you were a customer of the utility that had
I don't fit into one of those categories to where the benefits of the allowances are being distributed.
I think you would. You would fit. You were a residential customer of the utility. As I understand the bill, I think you might. Senator Whitson, what I can't answer is exactly what kind of rate impact any particular rate class is going to have. But as I read Section 12, most of that revenue that comes back from the sale of allowances will go to ratepayers in one form or another.
I'd like to point out also that obviously we have different opinions about the bill, but you're picking $150 a ton, and that just isn't in the ballpark of any market prices that I've heard, and that the previous panel mentioned number that was a carbon tax, which is a completely different approach and doesn't take into consideration complementary measures. So I'm just putting that on the record because you're doing a good job of scaring the hell out of everybody, and it's not the.
I didn't pick $150 a ton. Paul Warner did.
Yeah, well, that's.
This is legislative revenue figure.
Yeah, well, that's not the anywhere near the projected market price that I've heard that gets us to our goals. So, particularly if we have complementary measures. So,
Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Mr. Eisendorf, when you read Section 12. I want to clarify this. It says that it does say that there's bill assistance for low-income residential customers. So this bill clearly indicates that there'll be a tremendous rate impact on low-income earners. Is that not correct?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, a rate impact on a per unit rate, there would be an increase. And the interesting question is, on a net basis, do they do better or worse at the end of the year? Their rate has gone up, but they've then received the revenue from these allowances. So at this point, I'm unable to tell you what the ultimate impact.
And I'm not asking you for the impact. I'm just stating that this bill indicates that there will be a necessary assistance for low-income folks. And so then the next one was, we're going to have bill assistance for energy-intensive industrial customers because they're going to use a lot of energy, and they're going to have to be very costly. But the last one was the one that concerns me, and you said that there would be a rate relief for residential or small business, but it says residential or small business climate credits. Could you explain what a climate credit is?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, we had the same question, and so we did a little digging. So that is a term that was used in California, and that really is it's basically rate relief. It's not defined in the bill here, but that's how I assume looking around, that's how I assume the commission would define it, is it basically rate relief.
A follow-up? So essentially then what we're doing is we're selling credits, auction credits. The utilities are purchasing auction credits. We're transferring that cost to the ratepayers. The company collects the money, gives it to the you guys, and then you turn around and give it back to us. So there's, just like in the laws of nature, nothing is a perfect vacuum, so there's going to be losses. So somebody's going to lose on this. Somebody's going to have to pay money that they won't get back. Is that not correct?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I can't answer that. I don't know.
But you're the PUC. You're going to have to regulate this.
Well, to the extent that the premise is that there's going to be a loss. If to the extent that all of that money comes back, it will all be redistributed back to ratepayers. You're assuming that loss in somewhere. I don't assume the same loss. So if there's not a loss, then ratepayers will get the value of the proceeds back.
Yeah, follow up. Yeah. So then your assumption is this is a revenue neutral. Section 12 is revenue neutral. Or have you not got into that yet?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, we have not gotten into that. Right. I mean, clearly there may not everyone is included, arguably, in that in this list of three here. And so what the ultimate net is, I'm not sure. And what any customer class increase is, I'm not sure also. I would say that this is, again, the theory, just talking theory, and as it works out, it would be the intent. To the extent that the utility can make investments, so in theory, it doesn't have to be either this or 4036. They can actually work together. And to the extent that the utility is reducing its carbon emissions ahead of, faster than the cap is coming down, that means that the utility will actually be having to buy fewer allowances than they're getting revenue from. That means that the utility in theory could be getting more money than they're paying in for allowances. And so as that gets distributed to customers, it's arguable that customers could do okay in this.
Follow up?
Yeah.
And the PUC will not be involved in handling or selling of the credits, distribution of credits or anything?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, no.
Okay.
We would not be in the market operator. We would not be that
role. Thank you for the opportunity.
Other questions?
Thank you for being here and providing some PUC perspective.
Thank you.
So we are going to, so I'm going to give everybody an update about where we are in the schedule. We've got a number of people left on this bill. We are going to have to limit the length of everybody's testimony, because there are a lot of people that signed up yesterday and a lot of people that came back. Usually when we carry it over, not that many people come back, and everybody came back. So we just don't have enough time to get through everything tonight. But we have a lot of people that came here from Tillamook and drove over for the next bill. So what we're going to do is we're going to do 1 minute getting through the rest of the folks on this particular bill. Then we're going to move to the next bill and get through Senator Johnson and folks that came from Tillamook, and then
or just 100 miles away.
Well, yeah, or 100 miles away. I know a lot of people didn't mark 100 miles away, but I believe a lot of people are from Tillamook, and I don't know what the mileage is, but they didn't mark it on the sheet, so.
That's Chair, I want to make certain that we're not giving favoritism to one portion of the state. It's anyone
that's
100
right.
miles. That's
yeah.
all I'm trying to say.
Fair enough. So that's what we're going to do. And if you have more testimony, then you can give in a minute on the Healthy Climate Act. I encourage you to submit your testimony for the record and. So that we get it, and we've had a lot of testimony the last 2 days, and so anyway.
Mr. Chair, if I may recommend that if you don't have it typed up or written up, if you want to email anyone We can submit it for you. We'll get it into the record for you.
Or you can just send it to Beth, our committee administrator. So,
record's open.
Okay, so next up, we're going to go to Stephanie Swanson, James Valdez, and Lori Doherty. And then on deck, so if those three would come forward, on deck we have Greg Ballison, Mike Sullivan, and Bill Cluding. And I will wave my pen when the alarm goes off, and we are going to time it just so we can.
Where's everybody else?
Try to click through.
Are they not here?
They're coming.
Oh, are they?
Probably two rooms.
Go ahead.
Hi.
Mr. Chair.
Sorry, will you raise your right hand? Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear or affirm that the evidence you're about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do. My name is Lori Doherty. I live here in Salem. I did submit written testimony, and I won't read all of it in interest of time, but I just wanted to make a point that talk has been made about cost here, and I appreciate that. I don't have a lot of money myself, and I appreciate concern for cost, but there will be tremendous cost if we don't do anything about climate change. There will be cost, to agriculture from drought, losses from drought, from flooding. There will be costs to the state in general, from wildfires, from washouts of roads, and landslides and things that we have seen happen. And these are things that will happen more and more due to climate change. This is something that is pretty well documented, and those costs need to be taken into consideration if you are concerned about costs. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Good. So the other proponents on that panel aren't here, apparently. So Greg Ballison, Mike Sullivan, and Bill Cluding.
Okay, will you raise your right hand? Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear or affirm that the evidence you're about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Go ahead.
If you don't mind, Chair Edwards and committee, for the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I am the political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, and I defer my minute to Vice President Greg Pellison.
Chair, committee members, thanks for the opportunity to talk with you about this biggest issue facing all of mankind, and it really is. I'm Greg Pellison, Vice President of the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, affiliated with the Carpenters Union. I'm going to talk just a few minutes about the impact on the pulp and paper industry and people in the community in rural areas. But I have a quick question for you all. I'm curious. How many of you used paper products or wood products in the last 5 days? How many in the last 5 minutes? Well, let me try to narrow it down. Who has not used them in the last 5 seconds? Welcome to reality. Perhaps we should have a carbon footprint labeling on products along with a carbon tax on imports coming from high-emitting CO2 manufacturers. Excuse me. Our industries are under tremendous international competition. I'll provide you with the list. I won't go through it all, but every mill in Oregon that is closed has been approved for Trade Act benefits, TAA benefits. North Bend, Albany, Salem, Oregon City, now the Newburg Mill. The Newburg Mill has been certified twice before, and they'll be certified again. And you don't get those benefits unless you can prove and show you've closed because of unfair trade agreements. Every one of these mills retooled. They invested heavily in energy-efficient equipment. Albany got awards recognized by the state for their energy efficiency. Blue Heron used 100% recovered recycled paper. West Rock, 100% recovered recycled paper. They were the last mill in Oregon that ran with 100% recovered recycled paper. And the closures aren't just here. I could go through a list. I'll provide you with the list. Nationwide, the list is about a 60-page printout. Weyerhaeuser Longview, Georgia-Pacific Camas, downsizing. Kimberly-Clark Mill in Everett, Washington, profitable mill. Closed the equipment, moved to South America, brought back online. Every mill that's closed, the equipment gets sold, moved somewhere, brought back online. And for every one of our jobs lost, five other permanent jobs lost. Just real quick, I'll end with this. The pulp and paper industry is not a dying industry. 70% of the U.S. recovered waste paper, what we recycle, 70% is now exported overseas. And that you have a handout that's there, recovered, or the, you can see what's there on the China imports, but I'll just end saying that, you know, we should be taking action, and we need to, but this is not an Oregon issue or a Washington State issue or a regional issue. You've heard many times that if you are not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. This bill is part of the problem. It will increase pressure and drive pulp and paper overseas. And again, China makes more pulp and paper products than anybody in the world and pollutes the most. Thank you.
Chair Edwards, Committee for the Record, Bill Clinton, Carpenters and Industrial Council. I'm going to come at a little bit different direction. I'm going to show you what the biggest greenhouse gas emission is in this state. And it's forest fire. The EQ, along with the EPA, in 2002, they done a study on how to figure out how much emissions comes off of forest fire. And I'll just skim down through some brief answers here. They found that 90% of the wood smoke from forest fires can go directly into the human lung. Last night, we heard a young lady talk about health problems in Oregon. The Biscuit Fire, 500,000 acres, it put three million pounds of particulate matter, small enough to go in the lungs, in the air. One fire. In 2007, hundreds of thousands of acres burnt. It produced 4.5 million pounds of particulate matter, small enough to go into the lungs. EPA states forest fires nationally, 2000 to 2005, unleashed 562 million tons of carbon. In addition, greenhouse gas emissions, mainly CO2 from forest fires. In 2007, 56 teragrams was released in the air. A teragram is 1 million ton. Along with that, carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, ammonium, volatile, organic compounds.
Sorry.
I know, sir. I appreciate the time. No. Thank you.
I wish I didn't have to. So.
I'll get this to you.
The information. Thank you. And I'd love to talk with you more about the study.
I'll get this copy.
I'm familiar with the studies as well. So, anyway, we spent a whole hearing before we even teed this bill up on forest fire and how this bill can help with first strike resources. Next up, we have Tom Wolf, Charlie Fisher, John Charles. And then on deck, we have Bill Hoyt, Walt Eager, and Ernest Kuntz. We'll wait till everybody gets it so we can administer the oath once. Sorry, Tom, I forgot to tell you you were on deck. So. Okay.
Will you please raise your right hand? Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear or affirm that the evidence you are about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Charles, Cascade Policy Institute. I'll just comment on one part of this bill that hasn't really been discussed too much, which is that the basis of the bill is that you are creating a new syntax. The money to be spent in various euphemistic ways in sections 12 through 17. And the history of the legislative use of sin taxes is not very promising. Tobacco taxes, after the Master Settlement Agreement, the money, you took all the money and spent it for things unrelated to the agreement. You even sold bonds, so you securitized the money. So you're now actually in bed with the companies. You need to sell tobacco products, otherwise you'd be defaulting on the bonds. Lottery started out as a small program, now it's gigantic. you securitize future revenue. You need people to be addicted to the lottery program. Marijuana, that was legalized in part because, you know, we smoke dope for kids because some of it goes to schools. To say that it's very problematic what you're doing. You actually collectively through these programs, you love sinful activities because as long as you get a cut of the action, so just be careful about what you wish for here.
Thank you for sharing your testimony and perspective.
Chair Edwards, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I've sent in my testimony electronically, so I don't need to say anything except as a fish person, climate change is the elephant in the room. This bill would do something about it. We urge you to support it. Thank you.
That's a record.
Any questions?
Good job. Okay.
Thank you both. Okay, Bill Hoyt, Walt Eager, and Ernest Kuntz on deck. Stephanie Swanson, James Valdez, second call for them, and Charlie Fisher, Les Perkins. Okay, so Bill Hoyt, Walt Eager, and Ernest Kuntz. Okay, going once, going twice. Oh, please.
Yes, please, sit down. Only one?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. I get 3 minutes then, don't I?
Nice try.
I knew that.
Will you please raise your right hand?
Yes.
Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear or affirm that the evidence you are about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Did a quick rewrite to try to fit into your 1 minute.
Oh man, I don't know if you can get 3 pages in 1 minute, but summary would be great.
These are double spaced. You got the whole works right there.
Okay.
Chairman Edwards, members of the committee, I'm Walt Eager, a resident of Corvallis, Oregon. I am a retired energy and environmental engineer and also have experience in transportation engineering. I have an additional graduate level education and experience in a related physical science and life sciences. Consequently, I'm deeply concerned about climate change. I recently conducted an evaluation of all carbon pricing bills that were considered by the 2015 legislature, as well as the California and British Columbia carbon pricing laws. I will summarize this study most important findings in this testimony. A more complete summary is provided on a blog on my website. A link to it is at the bottom of the printed presentation that you have. Each bill was evaluated against a careful set of standards. These were deduced from a basic definition of the human-caused climate change problem and the political conditions under which it must be resolved. The most important of these is the vulnerability to political attack by the fossil fuel industries. The Frontline Investigative Report, Climate of Doubt, describes the public disinformation and political coercion campaigns conducted by these industries at the national level. They prevented the U.S. Congress from enacting a national carbon pricing bill. That is why we are here today. So it is imperative that Oregon's carbon pricing bill have a provision that makes it immune to attack by these industries. Here's how this attack is likely to be conducted against the Oregon law. That is based on the provisions of Senate Bill 1574. It would be staged after the law has been enacted and its first increment of carbon fees have been passed on by these industries for all Oregon consumers, the large majority of which are voters, to pay. They will pay them as price increases on nearly all products and services they purchase because fossil fuels are so extensively used throughout our economy. Unless consumers, voters, are adequately compensated for these price increases, expect these industries to mobilize a majority of them in political actions to repeal this law. It is unlikely that Oregon will ever recover from this avoidable event and be able to enact an effective carbon pricing law. The time to enact the most effective law that is not vulnerable to attack by the fossil fuel industry is now.
The only law that will be immune to attack is one that returns all consumers, all net carbon fee income as dividends, preferably paid monthly to each household, relative amount based on the number of consumers in it.
You're after for a cap and dividend? Then?
Pardon me?
You prefer a cap and dividend approach?
Is I prefer a fee and dividend approach.
Fee and dividend, okay. If you could wrap up, I'm sorry.
The only carbon pricing bill with dividend provision that were considered by the 2015 legislature was House Bill 3176. Minor wind charges, it needs to be looked at from the standpoint of it can be made into a fee bill instead of a tax bill. And we need to talk with the Revenue Committee to see if we can get that done. And I'll leave the rest to your reading. It's really important that we do that, and it's an excellent bill.
Thank you. Thank you for making the effort to be here and sitting through the hearings.
Incidentally, I would like to leave you with a couple one item while the next group is coming up.
Okay.
This is the merchants of doubt. This is the basic strategy that the fossil fuel industry uses. It's well-documented, very popular book. This is I'm going to leave it with you. This is a DVD that gives an overview of that book. Okay. It tells you what you're going to be facing with 1574 and what you need to find a way to get around. And that this other bill is the way to do that.
Thank you.
I would like to have this after you.
Okay.
Give it
to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, last call, Bill Hoyt and Ernest Kuntz. Okay, here. Last call, Charlie Fisher and Les Perkins. Okay, they're not here. Carl Fink, Jana Castellum. Go ahead. And I know both of you have more than a minute, and I really apologize that we just got them.
Will you please raise your right hand? Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear or affirm that the evidence you're about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Carl.
Senator Edwards and members of the committee, thank you for having me. We will try and be as brief as possible. It's a bit unfortunate because... My name is Carl Fink, and I'm here on behalf of NPSI, the Northwest and Intermountain Power Producers Coalition, and we are the independent power and electric sellers in Oregon. And it's important to recognize that we actually have a larger carbon footprint than the utilities who spent quite a bit of time in front of you. We are probably the industry that is going to be most affected by this bill. It will cost us a great deal of money. But you know what? We think it's great, and we support it fully. Cap and trade in this form is the only way that we can really get this done. But I want to point out a couple things. First, this bill is completely complementary with the other bill that we've been talking about. There's nothing that stops us from having both. They actually target different things. Second, all the questions that we've been asking and talking about today, there are answers to them because this has been done in a number of different areas. This has been done in Quebec, it's been done in California, it's been done in Ontario, and the answers are easy. How do we control costs of worrying about $150 a ton? Easy. The DEQ sets a cap, says whatever the cap would like to be. You want to make that $25, $75, you put a cap on it. What do you do about the coal that's coming in from out of state? Easy. In California, if my companies transmit power into California, we are part of their plan. It is not complicated. These are all tried and true things that occur in many of the other states. There are a few aspects of the bill that we would like to change at the margins. For example, as I mentioned, we do pay if we generate power and move it into California under their plan. We'd like to make sure we don't pay twice. And there are other things that we can work on. But generally speaking, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. This is a tried and true plan. It has been extremely successful. It is easy to work through the regulations to make sure that the money goes where the money should go, that it doesn't cost, and it is the only way that we are really going to see the reduction in carbon that we are seeking. And I'd be happy to answer pretty much any question that you have because I've been working on these matters throughout the continent.
Thank you.
Chair, committee members, my name is Jana Gastelum. I'm Climate Program Director at the Oregon Environmental Council. I'm here because I'm a mom and I have family who have been impacted by what I believe are climate impacts. I have family in Colorado who lost their home to forest fire after one of the hottest, driest Junes on record. All that was left really intact was a teacup. They lost all family mementos. I also have two kids who were born here in Oregon, and I want them to grow up in an Oregon that is healthy and has economic vitality, and I believe that this bill helps with both. Jurisdictions that cap pollution and reinvest revenue see benefits. In California, there was 3.1% job growth after the implementation of this program, and part of that is because they reinvested revenue in very smart ways. The Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in the northeastern states has resulted in $1.6 billion in economic growth, 16,000 new jobs, and reducing fossil fuel imports has kept $756 million in the regional economy. I want that for my kids, and I want that for your kids as well. Thank you.
Can I ask Mr. Fink a question?
Sure.
Mr. Fink, in British Columbia, they do have cap and trade. That's correct. What did they do to offset the impact of cap and trade?
British Columbia doesn't have cap and trade. They have a tax.
They have a carbon tax.
Yes. Yes.
But what they did is they lowered taxes on corporations, didn't they?
I believe they have a revenue neutral.
Yeah, so they lowered taxes on corporations.
And people.
Yes.
And this doesn't do that, does it?
This does do that, I believe, because what it does is allow you to use a market approach to get to the best solution that will lower costs for everybody. And bear in mind that every time someone comes up with a solution to lower carbon, that is permanent. If an industry comes up with something and says, you know, these costs are going to be high for us, what else can we do? And they come up with a technological change. That change is there forevermore, and that's going to improve the Oregon economy, and it's going to improve our competitiveness.
Thank you.
Thank you both. And, of course, you can submit your testimony. We'd like to see it. And thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, that wraps up the list of folks that had signed up to testify on Senate Bill 1574. So we are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1574, and we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1517. I know Senator Przanski may not be able to stay to the end of the folks that we're trying to get through tonight, but I just wanted to that you have an obligation that you need to get to. So if we could first, Senator Johnson, if you could come forward with your folks, Commissioner Labhart, and I don't know if you have arranged any more that you'd like to present with to begin with.
We do, sir. There are three of us, Ms. Nash from the Farm Bureau and Commissioner Labhart and me, and okay. Commissioner Labhart's going to go first.
Great.
Senators, thanks. Thank you all. It's been a long day. I'm going to try to go as quick as I can. Appreciate your attention. Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, for the record, my name is Mark Labhart. I have the privilege of serving. I'm going to just be less than 3 minutes, sir. I have the privilege of serving for the last 12 years as Tillamook County Commissioner. I also serve on the Association of Oregon Counties Legislative Committee, and I also serve on the Board of Directors of the Association of Oregon Counties. I have been asked by the association to represent the position of the 36 counties in my testimony before you tonight. In summary, Senate Bill 1517 requires certain findings of the local governing body for creation, restoration, and enhancement of wetlands and exclusive farm use zones. Our association voted unanimously to support the bill, and we ask you to also support the bill with the Dash 3 amendments and move it forward. I would like to personally thank Senator Edwards and Senator Olson for their leadership in helping to craft this bill that will hopefully pass muster with this committee. They both took the time out of their busy lives, along with Senator Johnson, Senator Roblin, and Representative Gomberg, to come to Tillamook County on a very rainy and cold day to tour several wetland restoration sites with representatives from the Farm Bureau, the Tillamook County Creamery Association, the Governor's Office, the Nature Conservancy, Tillamook Estuaries Partnership, and others to better understand the issue before us in rural Oregon. I also appreciate the follow-up meeting that they held with various interest groups here in Salem to help work collaboratively to draft the legislation that you have before you today. This bill allows rural Oregon and local governments to have a say in what happens in their communities. I'm going to use the Harney County example here. An example, what you can do to make things happen. No, it's not the occupation and what a group can wrongly do to force their things to happen. It's local government in Harney County that work closely with the environmental groups, landowners, the governor's office, and federal agencies to craft a solution to the sage-grouse issue. The end result was a decision by the federal government not to list the sage-grouse. Lots of work was done by some really good decision makers at the federal government, lots of dedicated people to make it work. The local government had a key role in helping to make that happen. We want this collaborative process to happen with farmland and wetland restoration projects. Right now, local government essentially has little to no say in the conversion of prime Oregon farmland to wetlands in their counties. Let me say right up front, we support wetlands restoration where it is appropriate. It is desperately needed to restore prime coho habitat in our case and other bird, fish, and other wildlife species in other parts of the state. We also need to protect our vanishing prime farmlands throughout Oregon. A key component of Oregon's land use system is the protection of farmland and forest lands. We take this very seriously in Tillamook County. We all want you to continue to eat Tillamook cheese. There are opportunities to convert and restore poor quality farmlands and wetlands where appropriate. Local governments are close to the ground. We are close to the people. We know and work collaboratively with other natural resource agencies just as they do in Harney County and around the sage-grouse issue. We want the opportunity to vote to develop collaborative processes and not just have the state or the federal government tell us, we know what's best for your county, so just live with it. There are likely some people in this room today that will testify against this bill because they don't believe local governments should have a say in what happens in their communities, or they see local governments as an impediment to their desires. Oregon's land use laws were built on a process of collaboration and working together. That's what the Oregon way is. We in local government are asking and pleading with you to give us a seat at the table as decisions are being made essentially without our input. We applaud the governor's office for working with the Farm Bureau, environmental groups, Association of Oregon Counties on this important issue. While they proposed amendments that do not fully address the issues before us today, we are very appreciative of the governor's office and their staff and their willingness to come to the table and offer a proposal for consideration. I believe it is a clear recognition that local governments do have a role in decision making that directly affects rural Oregon. AOC believes that the Farm Bureau amendments do provide an opportunity for meaningful county engagement in this issue. We look forward to continuing discussions at the work session and hopefully reach agreement on this important issue. Thank you for considering my testimony, and thank you for staying so late tonight and being so attentive. Appreciate it.
Marianne, go.
Thank you, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. Before I start, about how long would you – I can talk about this for a very long time, and I know we're short on time.
Well, take the time you need to explain
okay.
the bill.
Okay.
People need to understand what's happening here. So,
thank you very much. So I really appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today on this legislation. This is something that the Farm Bureau has been working on. I believe this is our third session bringing this issue forward, so we really appreciate the committee's attention to the issue.
Your name?
Oh, sorry, Marianne Nash from the Oregon Farm Bureau. The crux of the issue that we are trying to address here is the impacts of wetland restoration projects on neighboring agricultural operations and on agricultural land use patterns in the state. And it really is for us about creating some fundamental fairness and opportunity for engagement in the process. Right now, wetland projects are what's considered a sub one and outright permitted use in farm zones, which means that the counties don't have any opportunity to review, impose conditions on, consider impacts to neighboring operations for wetlands projects. There's some projects do go through a DSL permitting process, but wetlands restoration projects also are covered by a general authorization, which means there's also no notice or opportunity through that process. And those projects can have significant hydrologic impacts on neighboring properties. We have seen an increase in complaints from our members over the last several years that they have when their neighbors who are longstanding agricultural operations sell to conservation groups and those properties get converted to wetlands, that there's impacts both on the agricultural land base as a whole and on neighboring property owners in the form of flooding, groundwater conditions that change. And a lot of times it's been the vegetation start to convert to the more, I'm calling them hydric, I don't pronounce it correctly, but the water-friendly types of vegetation instead of the cropland that was there before. And so these projects do have the potential to have a really meaningful impact on neighbors, and farmers don't have a meaningful opportunity to engage in that process right now. Our proposed amendments are a compromise from what we offered last session. Last session, we wanted to make wetland projects what's called a sub two, a conditional use, which means that the counties would have been able to impose additional conditions on the project if they wanted to. Our current proposal leaves them as a sub one use, but subjects them to certain county review criterion that look at the impacts on neighboring operations. So they can't significantly increase the cost of neighboring operations or force a significant change in neighboring agricultural operations. And then we added a third criteria that looks at if the project alone or in combination with other projects would alter the stability of the land use pattern in agricultural areas. And we really are, particularly in the coastal regions and the valleys, seeing an incredible increase in these projects. They've been named by DLCD as one of the main sources of conversion of farmland. And there's really not any local voice in that process right now, any local opportunity for input. So the land use amendments seek to provide balance in that the counties can look at those three factors, but they could not impose additional factors. So they'd be limited to looking at impacts to agriculture and impacts to neighbors. It's important to note that through that process, we are in no way seeking to make it more difficult to create wetland projects or to say that those aren't welcome on agricultural lands. We have a lot of landowners that have been working cooperatively with conservation groups on these types of projects for years. Rather, we think it's important that when they come into agricultural areas, those projects are designed in a way that they don't have an impact on the productive farm uses next door, and they aren't making it more difficult for people to farm their land. We've seen several instances where people have tried to, they've had farmland that's become less productive, and then that when they're looking to sell that, people are saying, oh, I don't know if I want to be next to a wetland. I think there's a lot of carryover impacts, noxious weeds, flooding, other impacts from those projects that just, there's not an opportunity for local engagement on those issues right now. So that's the first component of the bill, the land use provisions. The liability provisions, and now I'm going to speak very directly to our Dash 3 amendments because we made a significant change to address some of the concerns we had heard from folks about not wanting to chill conservation projects. The liability amendments seek to close what I've come to view as a likely loophole in the current structure. Right now, under Oregon law, if you are doing a habitat conservation project in cooperation with ODF&W or OWEB, which most of them are these days, landowners, timber owners, and operators are exempt from liability for any damages associated with that project. So that means if that project causes water trespass onto a neighboring property or was negligently designed and causes impacts to neighbors, a landowner would be insulated from liability under current law for that. We have seen an increase in landowner conservation groups buying properties and then converting them to agricultural use. So they are not only the landowner, but they also then are the project designer and contractor. And in those scenarios, because of that landowner liability protection, even though they were the project designer and contractor and they would have been liable if they were doing it, for example, on leased property or on a in a cooperative project with a farmer, when they become the landowner, they get the benefit of the liability protection even when they're the project designer or contractor. And so our modifications seek to clarify that a landowner is insulated from liability only when they are not the project designer or contractor, so that it basically puts them on parity with folks that are doing projects on agricultural land, but they aren't the landowner. So it would still retain the protection for innocent landowners, but would make sure that in all instances, project designers and contractors are liable for any damages resulting from their actions. The third component, and I'll be very brief on this one, seeks to increase the current removal fill exemption from 50 cubic yards to 100 cubic yards. We had heard concerns from conservation communities that there wasn't very many sideboards on that. So in the Dash 3 amendments, we incorporated the specific permit conditions from the existing general permit for this work, as well as the in-water work periods for if you are an essential anadromous salmonid habitat, ESH. And so those were an attempt, again, to hopefully offer a proposal that makes folks comfortable and that has some of the sideboards that are in existing law. So really the only change vis-a-vis the general permit would be the notice and reporting requirement that has just proven to be pretty burdensome for landowners. So with that, I think I'll take questions because I know we're very short on time.
Why don't we go Senator Johnson and then...
I'm going to back clean up for the record. Betsy Johnson, Senate District 16. I vividly remember standing in Sean Dewar's barn in Tillamook last fall during a tour. The wind was blowing sideways and it was pouring rain. While we were all freezing cold, there was a general sense of camaraderie and common purpose. I want to thank Commissioner Labhart and others who set up that tour, and Marianne Nash, who has shepherded this bill draft through, having made a number of concessions already to address special concerns. At some point, further concessions to this bill will neuter it. I respectfully ask the committee to move the amended bill forward. We can't let the perfect get in the way of the good. Rural and agricultural Oregon needs a hand, and this bill is designed to do just that. If we all care about preserving the farm fabric, and by that I mean the ability for large tracts of agricultural land to continue to function as ag land without inflated purchase prices, without breaking up ag transportation routes, without breaking up large blocks of contiguous farming operations, maintaining the ability of lands for purchase or lease to local farmers rather than distant third-party owners, the avoidance of imposing additional cost on adjacent landowners, the ability to maintain adequate drainage, the avoidance of damage to proximate farming. If we value those characteristics of farmland, then I urge you to support Senate Bill 1517 as amended and pass it forward. This is a good bill.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator Johnson. Could you clarify the amendment you would like? There's a two and a three.
I believe they're in it. There are three of them. Ms. Nash actually wrote them. I know them in concept. I would defer to her superior expertise.
Thank you.
Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, we are trying to move the Dash 3 amendments.
For the record.
The Dash 3 amendments.
Thank you very much.
And I believe the Dash 2s are from the governor's office. I'm getting ahead.
That is correct.
Okay. Other questions for this panel?
Yeah. I have a question for Marianne. Can you remind me the removal fill piece, why is that needed to double the size? Could you explain that?
Absolutely. Chair Edwards, Senator Dimbrough, that's a really great question. The issue is the current 50-cubic yard exemption is it's not enough to clean the agricultural ditches that landowners have. 100 cubic yards, to be honest, probably isn't enough either. If you're trying to avoid people having the expense of having to come back and chip away at a problem a little bit at a time year after year, the 100 cubic yards gets you a little further, but not too much further. But we were hopeful that was a small enough increase that people would think it was reasonable and it would move. But the 100 cubic yards is probably not sufficient for a lot of landowners as it is. That said, we think that would start moving the ball forward in the conversation, and I was hoping in particular that the sideboards would allow people to just be able to do this and understand what the constraints are on doing it and actually stop having some of the conflicts that we've been having with the Department of State Lands over whether, how, when folks should be cleaning their ditches.
And if... If I could add, Senator Dembro, it has been my experience in working a number of these as constituent cases that these are not pristine salmonid habitat. They're a ditch. And organic material grows into the ditch. It sloughs off into the side. If we are going to maintain farmland and keep good stewardship of the land, we have to effectuate good drainage. And so in most cases, these are man-made ditches that are essential to keeping cows from standing in their tummies up to mud. This is part of just good land stewardship.
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembro, it can be said that, yes, you're doubling it, but we're talking five dump truck loads. Five. That's all it is. 10-yard dump truck, five dump truck loads. It's not a lot, and we desperately need that to be able to continue to adequately farm and clean these ditches so we can get adequately drained.
No, I appreciate that explanation. I was just wondering why it's in this bill. Not that it has anything directly to do with the wetlands issue, but because we're dealing with the same population, the same location, kind of multiple problems. Is that
so, Senator Edwards, or Chair Edwards, Senator Dembro, I actually tried to get a relating to clause of maintaining agricultural drainage on this one because to me these relate to the same function, which is when you're farming in wet areas, you need to make sure that you can adequately drain your property. Neighboring wetland projects have had the effect of changing groundwater levels, causing flooding impacts, and just altering the hydrology of the area. Maintaining agricultural drainage, again, cleaning those ditches, helps you maintain the drainage. And so to me, they really do both get at an issue of needing to keep productive farmland productive in wet areas. So there's a relationship there. It's it has to do with the fact that Western Oregon's incredibly wet.
I just wanted to make a couple of comments, actually. I mean, in Klamath, the Bureau of Reclamation Project in Klamath County and also in Modoc and Siskiyou County, California, are all reclaimed from an old lake bed, and the maintenance of those drainage ditches is seminal to being able to continue to farm. Part of the restoration agreement would be to reestablish salmonids in that area, in which case all of those drain ditches would connect to the rivers and would become potentially essential salmonid habitat. So it becomes very important to be able to have enough capacity to clean those ditches to make it work. On the wetland issue, several years ago, the Department of Transportation bought about a 30-acre pasture, and I know this because I drive by it every time I go to town twice. This was a pasture that had been irrigated and run cattle on for years. They bought it as wetland mitigation, and it makes perfect sense for the Department of Transportation because rather than creating a wetland the size of that dais there, they did 8 acres or 10 acres, and then that mitigates for a whole lot of stuff. For our community, it created a breeding area for mosquitoes, a fishing area for double-crested cormorants, and about 22 acres of noxious weed breeding habitat. Had our county commission had been able to weigh in on this, our county planning, it would never have been built there. Even though it makes perfect sense to ODOT, it makes no sense to our community.
The I guess this question is for Mary Ann. So what's the process? If you can only get five dump truck loads and that's not enough, then what's the next step? For those of us that aren't that familiar with getting a removal fill permit, what's the process?
So, Chair Edwards, speaking
directly, not the expert, we can get
directly to the drainage component. I think some of the producers would be better able to speak to their needs than I would. That said, I think that this bill is part of an ongoing conversation that we're working and hoping and trying to have with the DSL to insert some practicality in some of the permitting requirements that we've seen imposed on producers. And I liked the idea of the conditions because it's a bit of a compromise between their existing general permit and an outright exemption. And so legally, I think that there's a lot of merit in this approach. As to the need and the how, I'll definitely let some of my producers speak to that.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to close by saying, and I left this out of my testimony, that when we gathered in Tillamook to start this conversation, in the group were farmers, the conservation community, the governor's office, all the local legislators, the major employer in the district, the creamery. And so we had started this conversation hoping to get to yes with a very diverse group of stakeholders who all had interests. And I would say that the general sense of compromise in Mr. Dewar's barn was that we needed to get this done. It was a get to yes time standing in the barn. And I sincerely hope that this committee moves this bill forward.
Senator Johnson, you remembered that as a rainy, windy day? I thought that was a kegger.
Thank you.
That was a perfect transition. Okay, next up, David Brocksmith and Mark Nystrom.
Mr. Chair, I'm willing to stay as long as you want.
Okay. And then on deck, we'll have Brian Pohl and why don't you guys just go ahead while I figure out who the next panel is.
Chair Edwards, I think Brian left too, so.
Yeah, okay.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, I'm Mark Nystrom. I'm the policy manager for the Association of Oregon Counties. I'll be really brief. AOC voted unanimously to support this bill. The -3 amendments were explained to us, and that's the version that we voted on. And so I'm here just to introduce Curry County Commissioner David Brocksmith.
Thank you, Mark. Chair Edwards, committee. I'll be brief myself, and if you knew me, my constituents would tell you that's a feat in itself. David Brocksmith, Curry County Commissioner. I just wanted to reiterate what my colleague Commissioner Labhart has already testified as a colleague commissioner from the southwest part of the state. And as well as a member of the Association of Oregon Counties Legislative Committee and AOC Board, I'm here to tell you that we all agree on this bill with the -3 amendments. And if our colleagues from Malheur County or Wallala County in the southeast or the northeast part of the state could be here today, they would be testifying along with us. This is a statewide issue, and these amendments along with this bill give our local counties and their farmers the tools that are needed. And to that end, I just want to remind everyone of President Courtney's message at the Oregon Business Leaders Conference and how we need to work together collaboratively with cooperation to assist our citizens and the folks throughout the state, as well as Minority Leader McLean's conversation and his ask for urban Oregon to assist rural Oregon, as well as the comments from Senator Johnson to the same. So urge you respectfully to support Senate Bill 1517 with the -3 amendments and help us in rural Oregon have some tools to work through these issues. Thank you.
Thank you both. Any questions for the panelists? Okay, thank you. Next, we're going to go to, Shannon Lorenzo, Casey Allen, and Joe Rocha. And then after that will be Joe Jenk, Tim Murphy, and Brian Pohl, if he's here, but it sounds like he might not be here. So Shannon Lorenzo, Casey Allen, and Joe Rocha. And I apologize ahead of time if I mispronounce anybody's name.
That's a Rocha, not Rocha.
Okay. I had a feeling.
You go ahead.
Do Go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Senator Edwards, for giving us this opportunity to meet with you. We are so ecstatic that people like our Senator Betsy Johnson has pushed this for us. And we
For the record.
Joe Rocha. And comes and is willing to see our concerns and has helped us so much try to find a solution to what's going on. I dairy out in Tillamook, and we live out towards the bay. So clearly all of that land over generations has been maintained in an agriculture state by drainage districts and dikes and et cetera, that we have to comply with the division of land and everybody else to do all of these things. But what happens is somebody, my neighbor, sells his place, and all of a sudden, he sold it to the Nature Conservancy or somebody else who's going to make a wetlands out of it, which is a use on the land. That's fine. The problem is he impacts me by my land all of a sudden doesn't drain as good. They're not interested in moving the land, the water away. They're interested in bringing the water in. So we as farmers are all into doing projects that improve the environment. If someone would come to the table with us, we're vastly ready to go ahead and improve the land and the environment that'll actually kind of benefit everybody instead of the process that it goes through now. We just feel that this bill is so important to us because it will bring all the parties to the table and get to have a say in what's going on. And also the amendment of adding the 100 yards. Really, we have almost more than 100 yards that comes in the sediment into our ditches in a flood event. So this really is not even keeping up with what can come back in. It's really important that we kind of edge away at this. It's something that everybody can live with. So I don't want to take too much time. So,
go ahead.
My name's Casey Allen. I was also in the barn with Betsy Johnson. It was raining and cold. But I'd like to mention I own the dairy directly across the river from the Sean Dewar project, and it has had fast effects on everything. It affects me, the farmers up the river. It doesn't even look nice. It looks like a bomb went off. They tore the riverbank, all the riparian area out, and everything else. And all the geese still land on my side, so I don't know what wildlife refuge they produced. And I also once again want to thank Betsy Johnson, Mark Labhart, and and my brother. You'll hear him talk. He'll talk a lot more, trust me. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Shannon Lorenzo. I'm also a dairy farmer in Tillamook, and all of us actually are on the board of directors of Tillamook County Creamery Association, and I guess that's the angle I'm going to take is the impact. We are the largest employer in Tillamook County, and to be competitive in our marketplace, we compete against the biggest dairy companies in the world, Unilever, Nestle, you know, and we have a premium product, yes, but we have to have our costs in line. And to do that, you have to be efficient at the plant level, and that means cows and milk. But that supports that is the land. And this bill, I think, it doesn't stop Nature Conservancy or groups like that from buying this property, but it definitely hopefully brings some accountability on this restoration projects and might slow these things down. So anyway, thank you for the opportunity.
Mr. Chair. Yeah. The one thing I always questioned when I was out there, and I forgot to ask this question: are you dealing with the wetlands? Are you dealing when they turned it into a wetland? Is it salt water, or is it brine, or is it fresh?
It would be different in all of the cases. In my area, it would be saltwater intrusion because I live closer to the bay. If you lived, and those are more of the projects they are. So, in my area, yes, that wouldn't be in all of the projects, but in the ones that him and I are speaking of, they brought the salt water closer to us.
All right, fellow. And how would that impact your dairy operation? Would it impact the milk, the quality and quantity of the milk?
Well, it will kill the kind of grasses that we grow, so yes.
And two things, not only the grass we grow, which is huge, you know, for us instead of having to buy it, but it's also we have to put manure back out on the land, and if it's saturated ground because of groundwater,
that's not good for the environment.
That's what affects cow numbers, and yeah.
Okay, so thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you each for your testimony. Next, we're calling Joe Jank and Tim Murphy and Brian Pohl, if he's here. If Brian's not here, this would be a good time for Chad Allen to come up. Chad, I'm sorry I missed you on the list. I was just looking for the words Tillamook, because I know a lot of people are here from Tillamook. and I scanned through everybody else, and most people that are signed up to testify on this bill are in the Capitol on a daily basis, so they'll have a chance. I'm going to carry the hearing over, so go ahead.
Senator Edwards and committee, my name is Joe Yank, Dairyman in Tillamook. Little part I guess I would throw in with the rest of them here, but just to give you an example, that project that they went to there at Dewars, when we're talking about this 50 or 100 yards of cleaning, they took a ditch that had gotten filled in the 64 flood and removed thousands of yards because they wanted to, they said, well, it got filled in the flood, so we're going to make it back into a ditch to flood the land. Yet I can't take out 50 yards of sediment in my drainage ditch. Now, where's the double standard here? We're saying that it happened naturally, this flood, and yet we're going to dig it back out to flood the land. Yet I can't clean a ditch to keep it drained. Something isn't there. There's got to be a balance, and this bill at least gives a little bit of balance to some of these things that are happening. If we want to keep farmland in this state, we created zoning to protect farmland. Now there's got to still be some protection for this farmland. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, Chairman Edwards, Senators. My name is Tim Murphy. I am a planner with Tillamook County. Our director, Brian Pohl, unfortunately had to leave. I have no comments prepared for this evening, but if you have any questions about how the county might handle these type of applications, I'm more than happy to address that.
Okay. My name is Chad Allen, for the record. I'd like to first start off by thanking Senator Edwards and Senator Olson for coming down to Tillamook and getting a bird's eye view of sort of the conflicts that agriculture in that community is facing with these types of non-farm uses. One approach I think that we've done differently in being more collaborative with the conservation groups in this is really illustrated in this bill. We've really made a great effort on taking those issues in consideration and still allowing this as an outright use, but subject to some review criteria. And the ultimate end conclusion of this is to design restoration projects that are going to ultimately be compatible with the agricultural industry in that community and the adjacent land use. It's not picking restoration over agriculture or one of the either, but actually a combination of the two. The farmers in all of Oregon have been the number one conservation active groups of anybody. Everything that we do is in order to conserve the agricultural benefits of our farms and also enhance the wildlife and water quality benefits that can be produced from them also. Tillamook County has fenced off miles of river riparian areas and have participated in planting to hundreds of thousands of trees. And so we're constantly looking for more opportunities to engage in projects that are compatible. When you start engaging with things that aren't compatible, then you become resistant to any conservation projects at all, and we don't want to do that. I'd certainly like to encourage you to move this bill forward. It is important for Oregon, and I'd leave it at that. Thank you.
Chad, could you talk a little bit about, I was struck that there are wetlands restoration projects, or at least one really large one that you highlighted mm-hmm. when I was there that mm-hmm. you were supportive of, and it sounded like it was a bitter pill to swallow for some of the community, but there was process and planning and community buy-in. And could you talk a little bit about how sort of the community kind of got to yes on that project?
Sure. And that project started clear back in the late 90s, and it's taken on quite a few different names and designs. But it's been a collaborative effort, and there's been periods through that process that it's been stalemated, that there wasn't any give or take at all on it. And then certainly after the bigger flood events that we had in the mid-2000s, we engaged in an Oregon Solutions process, and that brought all the players at the table. And we highlighted some of the priorities. We did some project work in the short term and putting some spillways in. There was some property that was purchased that was through OWEB dollars and ODFMW and U.S. Fish and Wildlife that sort of had some conservation interests tied to that, and getting as much salt marsh restoration in that property was a big desire. And so we started working on designs, and there was give and take and pushback, and we came finally to the conclusion that where we're at now, and that project has just started its process here just a few days ago. They started cutting some of the timber down that was grown on some of the old spoil sites from dredging projects that were done in the early 1900s. And then those spoil sites are going to be removed and brought back down to sort of the natural bank height. And then there's going to be some new levees put in. There's going to be better ag protection for the property that's going to be west of or east of that property now. But it hasn't been an easy road. But we made sure that whatever those project were going to be in that design work was not going to negatively impact the adjacent land use. Not because it was required, but because we went through the process and we made sure it was. And it wasn't an easy fight. We had extreme, a lot of high tempers, you know. It was some good Democratic arguing, for say the least. But we got to where we are today, and we can all get behind it now that we're involved in that process. We're going to have this project come right up to our back door on property that we own. And we actually engaged with the group that was for the restoration parts, and that we're entering our part of our land in trade for some usable ag ground, which is a head end of one of the historical blind sloughs, because we saw the restoration benefit if they were going to put that slough back into tidal flow, they might as well have all of it. And we had the head piece of it. And so we've been involved in lots of conservation things personally, and we saw the benefit of that. And so we engaged in it, and we made an agreement, and we traded some land for it. And so we're all pro doing things that are good for the fish. The fish are important to us here. Water quality, Tillamook County farmers have invested millions of dollars of increasing water quality. We have almost have every river in Tillamook County meeting water quality standards now. And that was from the hard work of the farmers and nobody else. And so, through our best management practices, we all have a confined animal operating permit book that's about an inch and a half thick. And we got inspectors that regulate that and make sure that we're following it to the letter. Our inspector is really particular about how he inspects. So, but anyways, if that answers the question.
It does, and I was mistaken in thinking that it was a little bit easier to develop that project than it was. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of head shaking no. So,
and I think though what Chad's point though is to make sure is the part that there was collaborative effort.
Right.
That both sides got a voice in it, and that more than anything, so that people, it isn't just so one-sided. That you have that these other owners have a voice in it, and the Nature Conservancy can say that they ask. Yes, they might say they can ask, but they don't have to. And they can, at the end of the day, right now, they can do as they please with it. So, thanks.
Okay, thank you. Senator Denbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Ms. Murphy, I do want to ask you about the process. And I think that, the piece having to do with the impact on adjacent property, you know, and it being harmful to the adjacent property through flooding or whatever. I think that that would be pretty, I'm not going to say easy. It would be easier if it's a collaborative process. I definitely agree with that. But the other piece that's in the bill about decisions about, you know, land use and how this affects the, you know, the agricultural nature of the community. I mean, it seems to me that's going to be harder for your agency to do. I mean, how do you see that working out?
It absolutely will be more difficult, Senator. But the standards that are being applied are standards that are typical to other projects that are in the agricultural zones. I think, like most new initiatives, we'll probably see the county making findings on an issue and somebody taking us to court about it. But that's the way our process works. It'll be highly a lot of discretion on our part.
Thank you each for making your way over here testifying. Next, we're going to call up Ed May and Kelly Beamer and Jerry Nicolescu. And I apologize if I mispronounced anybody's names?
You're an equal opportunity mispronounce.
Yeah. And sometimes I can't read the writing. And if I'm not sure, I always blame it on that. Go ahead, sir.
Senator Edwards and committee, my name is Ed May. I'm the public policy volunteer chairman for Oregon for Ducks Unlimited. Ducks Unlimited doesn't buy land. We develop wetlands projects on land owned by the federal government, the state, and private parties. We work cooperatively with those people to put these projects in. Obviously, wetlands are very important to us, as they are to all Oregonians. We count on them for clean water, a little bit of protection from floods, and certainly critical fish and wildlife habitat. And I noticed when I signed in, I had to be anti or for, and there should be a third category. Again, I'm very supportive of a collaborative effort. I've heard some very interesting things here today. It's been very educational for me. But I have to oppose anything that's going to alter the current importance of wetlands. However, I think it's important to work with all the partners. Ducks Unlimited spends a huge amount of time dealing with neighbors and making sure that we're a good neighbor when we do a project. And so we'll continue to evaluate this. I like some of the things I've heard today. In practice, obviously, if this bill becomes law, in practice and how that practice is applied is going to make or break our ability to do wetlands. And when county planning people sit down and determine how it's going to go, that's going to affect us or could affect us hugely. And so that's all I had to say.
Thank you.
Good evening. For the record, my name is Kelly Beamer. I'm executive director of the Coalition of Oregon Land Trusts. We're a statewide association that represents 19 land trusts that work all over the state of Oregon. Our members work with private, willing landowners to conserve water quality habitat, working farms, forests, and ranches around the state. And I submitted testimony that's before all of you that's on behalf of Colt and also my colleague here at the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts and the Network of Oregon Watershed Councils. And just to speak briefly, we together help implement voluntary conservation in Oregon. And this is an approach to conservation with the hope to avoid regulation and more regulation. These are landowners, again, going outside of Tillamook County, thinking statewide, who are making voluntary changes and stewarding their land. Together, our three organizations represent 160 groups in Oregon. I want to start out by saying how much that we really support Oregon's rich agricultural community. Many of our members work with farmers, ranchers, foresters. In fact, we find these folks are some of the best stewards, as was said earlier, of the land and care so passionately about protecting the natural resources. And we also support the restoration of wetlands. We see them as playing a key ecological function, especially in the face of climate change, which will impact a lot bigger issues that we have in hand. And the fact is we need both. And we've heard that eloquently said by Commissioner Lambert tonight. I want to say that I appreciate the effort of Marian Nash and the Farm Bureau to reach out to at least the Coalition of Oregon Land Trusts in the last few weeks. Unfortunately, we were not in the barn, and I haven't been privy to some of these tours, and this is relatively the specific examples I don't know very much about. But I want to speak broadly about the first two provisions of the bill. The first about changing the land use laws and adding a new layer of county review. I'm just concerned about the lack of clarity in what that might mean from county to county in terms of process for our members. I'm also interested in understanding where the current DSL permit fails. As far as I understand, major wetland restoration projects do have to seek a permit from the Department of State Lands that requires county sign-off and notification of neighbors. I'm curious to know these projects that are failing, where in that permit process are we not notifying neighbors, or is the county signing off where they perhaps shouldn't? What evidence needs to be brought forward? These are some of the questions I have that I would love to continue in an arena outside of this quick, short timeline we have tonight. Secondly, just pointing to the liability. Again, I appreciate Marianne's comment about supporting the willing landowners we have in Oregon who are doing restoration. I'm concerned about taking that away even from contractors. I think about some of our members who work with farmers in the Willamette who themselves are acting as contractors, doing that work on their land, creating buffers to protect their cropland. So I think there's a lot of questions that have to be answered still. I think that, you know, it sounds like there are true grievances happening on land, and as far as our members are very curious in learning more about those instances and exactly, you know, where is the breakdown happening. So we want to be partners. I think we all want these voluntary solutions and not have to resort to increased stringency on the regulation side. And I just want to express our willingness to participate in that longer dialogue.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jerry Nicolescu. I'm the executive director with the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts. I would bring to your attention that I, too, am a conservation group, although sometimes not thought of one because we're so closely aligned with ODA as far as the districts. Not to repeat what Kelly said, I have several concerns about this. And from a statewide basis, I understand what has gone on in Tillamook and the issues there that they have and sympathize with those. Having been a former dairyman myself, I understand some of the things they may have to go through. But I do have some concerns. In some of this, the sections where it talks about forcing a significant change, I'd like some definition. Significant to one person is not significant to another. Significantly increase the cost, what would be a significant increase to one may not be another. Surrounding lands, is that contiguous lands? Is that lands within a half mile? Where is that? I mean, because at one end of the county, because of the other end of the county, those kind of things. My major concern, not to take up enough time, is when we talk about the liability issues and we get to the new amendments in this, I'm afraid they might be taken as something that is done statewide. An owner of land other than the forest land, if the owner is not also a project manager or the primary party responsible for the completion of a project. Most of my landowners working on this do a lot of their own projects. They do a lot of their own design. And as the entity that has its name on the signatory part of an RCP project with the federal government for $9 million to address sage grouse, I worry that this could be one more thing out there that would cause landowners not to go ahead and do this because they're worried about whether they're going to pick up liability. Thank you.
Questions for panelists?
Yeah. I'm gonna screw your name up, Mr. Nicolescu.
Talk about a 5 cent piece, S and a Q.
Mr. 5 cent piece, S and a Q. I apologize. It's late. No. You mentioned at the very end there that you have people that do their own design and stuff like that. So the concern I would have is that if they're not articulate in how to do this work and they do impact a neighbor, shouldn't they have liability because of the damage they might have done?
I would say if it's gross negligence, if they're doing, I look at it if just for simple sake, sorry, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson.
It is late.
And I will tell you that with a name like mine, last name, when I got married, my wife didn't know my first name because everybody called me Nick until the day the minister pronounced it. So if a rancher in Harney County wants to fence off a lek, a drumming ground, and he wants to build his own fence around it, and it, somebody could say that, and we do have groups that want to see them listed, that could be a liability issue. And if he can't, he can do it himself. And this takes away if somebody wants to question that. I just think there needs to be more discussion about this.
Okay, that's fine.
Any other questions?
Just a comment, Ducks Unlimited. I'm from the Klamath area, in Tudor Lake, Lower Klamath, and so forth. The preponderance of the waterfowl feed on the adjacent lands next to the refuge. They don't feed in the refuge.
Primarily, you're correct.
And, you know, I mean, if you're down there early in the morning, as a veterinarian, I used to be down there really early in the morning. During the migratory season, the ducks and geese would come out of the refuge at Tudor Lake and or the Lower Lake Refuge, and in swarms by the thousands and the tens of thousands, and land in the fields to feed. A lot of times they would stay there all day, and you know, if they weren't disturbed, and then they come dusk, they fly back to the refuge. Sometimes they just stay over. So I think we have to have a balance, but we have to recognize that the maintenance of these farmlands, that's where the ducks and geese are getting their feed. Pasture land, adjacent to the rivers and so forth. So we have to be able to maintain the farmlands.
Senator Edwards, Senator Whitsett, you're correct. One of the primary projects DU does in that habitat in that area is to assist the farmers in maintaining their flood irrigation of their pastures because it benefits the waterfowl and the farmer. There's recreating the spring flood of the melting snow that would flood those pastures that the farmers count on or the ranchers count on for greening that water. We do those projects all the time with the farmer.
Just if I could respond to that, it puts the farmers in our area in quite a difficult position because there isn't adequate water to flood irrigate because we have reallocated the water for the fish and the birds. So you know, most of the area is now sprinkle irrigated. Mm-hmm. It's a little more productive that way, but the primary reason for doing it is to spread the water further, and of course that does not create wetlands. That creates the productive farmland, mm-hmm. which the birds feed on. So.
All right, thank you each for being here. And we have one last panel, and then we're going to call it for the night. And we will carry over the hearing after this last panel to our regularly scheduled meeting time tomorrow. But I think we have a few folks that are from a distance. Carl Zweifel, and then Peter Kanagi, Kathy Hadley, and Sharon Waterman.
Chairman Edwards, members of the committee, thank you for letting us speak. My name is Carl Zweifel. I'm a fourth generation farmer from Tillamook, the president of the Tillamook County Farm Bureau. And I'd like to just echo on the comments of Chad Allen on the importance of this bill. The construction of wetlands on the farmland in Tillamook County has been a significant issue for us. And the farming community feels that we have not had an adequate voice in, we want to be partners in the conservation. But in order to do that, we need to have the ability to have a meaningful voice in the process and remedy and the impacts. We also need a more streamlined removal of fill process to help us maintain drainage. Thank you for hearing us. Now, I wrote all that down and I'm listening. You know, we got to keep our ditches cleaned, and we, you know, 50 yards, it isn't enough. I know that's confusing. You know, the guy from Ducks Unlimited, I'd like him to come see all the conservation projects that are near where I live in Tillamook. There's no birds there. They come and they eat our short grass. That's how we make our living. You know, so I don't like birds because they eat my living. And on real quick, one more thing. I went to ODFW. I have a herd of 90 elk that eat all my grass and half a cornfield this year. I walked in there one morning and I said, hey, I want to know where this trailer load of elk's going to go. And they all looked at me like I was crazy. I said, I got their attention. They gave me some kill permits and we went on. But, you know, everybody looks at something different, and this bill is really important because when they take those dikes out, my grandpa and his dad helped build those things. And, you know, if your neighbor's rainwater was coming into your wife's rose garden, she'd have a fit, you know, and that you can't control that. But by taking those dikes out, they're flooding. I mean, you know, we are our biggest advocates, us farmers. I mean, we want the land to be productive. We want to make food for people. You know, that's it in a nutshell. I don't know. I'd love to say more, but everybody's got something to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, thanks for this opportunity. My name is Peter Kanegi. I live in Benton County, operate a 450-acre farm along the Willamette with approximately a mile of river frontage and a mile and a half of off-channel habitat. Unlike the folks, my colleagues in Tillamook, I have not experienced the direct impacts of wetlands adjacent to me. But I have, over the last 20 years, done a lot of wetland enhancement, riparian work on my farm. And I guess the piece that I would like to speak to is the liability issue. As a landowner myself, if I do something that impacts a neighboring landowner, I'm the one that should be liable. And that's one fundamental problem with the way that things are now, that people don't have the liabilities. So there's not the accountability to do the job well, to talk to the neighboring landowners and get the things right from the get-go.
Thank you.
Chairman Edwards and members of the committee, my name is Sharon Waterman. I'm actually a Coos County person, so I'm on the other end of the coastal area. There was a question about the permitting process, and I'd like to do a little bit more clarification on that for you. 2 weeks ago, Sunday, I sat in the middle of my living room. My husband is a chairman of one of our drainage districts that we own property in, and I started working on the joint individual permit to clean out our ditches in the Calito Drainage District. We got, the first part was, oh, okay, you can put your name and your address and those parts in without a problem. And then it gets to the HUC. What is your HUC name? What is the 12-digit HUC number? I don't know if you know what a HUC is.
I have no idea.
It's a hydrological unit, something or other. Well, so I have my computer on, and in my other hand, I have my smartphone. And so my smartphone, I go in and I type in what I need to find the hawk. Well, I found the name and I found the 12-digit number that corresponds. So then I go on down and I'm reading the directions as I'm filling out this application and my husband's filling me. And they want to know, well, what's the cowarding class? Well, it has something to do with the wetlands. I don't know, really. And I never did find that. And then there's the HGM. And we're farmers. We're not environmental technological oriented people. We need a permit process that is simple, that farmers and ranchers can fill out to clean out our ditches without having to know all of these other little keywords. There were some macroinvertebrates. There was a name for macroinvertebrates that I'd never heard of before. You know, they can't say macroinvertebrates. They have to have another name that you have to go look up because you don't know what it is. So the permitting process, which you may think is simple and easy, we tried to work with DSL, and I love DSL, but, you know, they don't understand. We're farmers. We're not. We don't work with that scientific language every day, day in and day out. So that takes care of that. Liability, every day we go out to work. Things that we do, we're liable for. As one person said the other day in a meeting I was at, farmers and ranchers wake up in the morning with liability in the morning, and it goes 24 hours a day. So when you do something to hurt someone else's property, then you're expected to take care of it. The last thing has to do with properties adjacent to wetlands. We have a proposed wetland, and as a rancher, we own two sides of the proposed wetland, probably a little over 2 miles. I'm not very good on numbers. So we want to get out. We're getting older. We have our place up for sale. Potential buyers. I have been giving since October. I have been providing information to a potential buyer as to this wetland. And his concern, he's hired a hydrologist. You know, it is these wetlands, whether you realize it or not, when you're talking about a 400-acre wetland in the middle of a 1,700-acre drainage district, it is a issue. And can we even sell our property? I don't know. Because everybody is concerned. What is it going to do? What is this potential project, going to do to our property? And we're concerned, too. You know, we don't know. We can't tell. You don't know till it happens. We're Bandon Marsh people. All of you that know Bandon Marsh know about the mosquitoes, unintended consequences, and you cannot, you know, there's nobody in this world that can determine all the potential unintended consequences in economics and to agriculture in these projects. So thank you very much. I appreciate your time, and if we can help you in any way, we'll be glad to do that.
I was impressed with your form, saying that you love your regulator. That is always do that. Always do that when you're testifying. I love DSL. Love DSL.
They weren't under oath.
Yeah. And you weren't under oath.
Was that a zinger?
No. Senator DeDembro was the one that pointed it out to me. Go ahead.
All right. Senator Edwards, Chair Edwards and members of the committee, my name's Kathy Hadley, and I manage and help operate two farms, one west of Salem in the Rickrell area and one in the Silverton Hills. And I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 1517 and the -3 amendments. My family farm was directly negatively impacted by almost 500-acre wetland project that borders our property to the west. The problems that have come up with this include increase with goose depredation issues, which means we have to spend more chasing geese off, and we get less revenue from crops because of the amount that they feed on through the year. There's an increased presence in noxious weeds because, frankly, the property is not managed to control them. We have increase in flooding. which has several impacts, but one is we have more erosion, and if we plant like new fields in the fall, we have to be very careful how we do that and where we do that, because we have more water coming across us, and also it leaves a lot of sticks out in our hay fields that we have to go and pick up. So you know, those are all direct costs to our operation from it. We've also had more elk moving through the area recently and utilizing that wetland as they move through. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with elk and their size, but they can be devastating to fencing for our cattle. And, you know, we don't know when they move through in the middle of the night until all of a sudden we get a call from our neighbor that our cows are out. So, because they've taken a fence down. You know, big picture, there's 500 acres off the tax roll in our county now. No taxable income being generated from that. And also, much of that property was previously tiled ground. So it really didn't make a lot of sense to turn it into a wetland when there's tile land under it, but that's what happened. From my knowledge and understanding from classes down at Oregon State and whatnot, wetlands best achieve their ecological purpose when they border as much of the production land as possible. And the year that NRCS funded this project, they turned down a number of smaller project requests, many of which were from farmers that we know around the county. And that number of projects would have been spread out geographically and had a much larger environmental benefit from those development dollars. I say all this to emphasize the importance of having an ability to have a voice in this process, and input on proposed conversions in EFU land, and additionally also the legal recourse for damage and impacts that are incurred. I secondly want to speak to the wording that increases the ability for us to be cleaning out existing ditches and maintaining drainage systems without as much recourse from DSL by having a little bit broader ability within that range without having to have a permit. A lot of times it doesn't take a lot of removal of soil to empty out the end of a tile line that can make the world a difference on a field. Even our Silverton farm at 1,200 feet, we utilize tile line in some areas. And the big thing with that, keeping those drainage systems open, is it actually protects against erosion by allowing the rainfall to soak in because the soil isn't oversaturated. And then that rainfall is absorbed instead of running across the surface and carrying topsoil with it, because that's what invariably happens. You know, I can show you firsthand, we have one plugged tile line, which can happen for a number of reasons, but water is working its way to the surface and then running across the top. And that's just from one small plug right at the end of the line that we're waiting until the water goes down to get cleared out. But, you know, it's a huge difference, and it doesn't take a lot, but that 50 to 100 yards I do think is a very helpful compromise, or cubic yards, excuse me. So just in conclusion, I think this bill is very positive for the valley with all the drainage we utilize and across the state, as you've heard. And I ask for your support of Senate Bill 1517 and the -3 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you each for your testimony. This is a difficult issue. There are, as we heard from testimony earlier, well, this is like many issues in this committee, there's no way to make everybody happy. So we're not really trying to make everybody happy. We're just trying to get some reasonable compromises and try to figure out a way to move forward. We wouldn't be hearing the bill if I didn't think that there were some really legitimate concerns. And so we'll continue to work on those. We're going to carry the hearing over to tomorrow. We still have like eight to 10 people yet to testify, and it's getting late tonight. And some of the folks that have yet to testify would be people with different perspectives, perhaps some local government folks, some tribes, Metro, Washington County, League of Wyndham Voters, Trout Unlimited. So we want to hear from a bunch more folks as well, and we'll continue to have these conversations. We're on a short timeline this legislative session, so just so everybody understands, the deadline for getting a bill out of this committee is next Thursday. So we're either working the bill out of here by next Thursday or it's next session. So, Senator Whitsitt?
I just wanted to reinforce something that the chair of the Farm Bureau there said. Our former generations built dikes and leveled land and built drain ditches, a lot of them with teams of horses and Fresno scrapers. I mean, it was really labor intensive. And they did it for a reason. And yet we have many in the conservation community who will come in and say, we're going to change that without ever asking why you built it in the first place. And the unintended consequences are horrendous.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yeah. I would just say thank you all for the time and effort that you put into this, but all those folks from Tillamook and not a single block of cheese? My goodness.
So before we...
We didn't know the drive.
I've missed some. Sir, why don't you come give us your testimony? I don't see...
Richard Obrist.
Richard Obrist.
My name was deleted for whatever reason. Sit down.
Please.
Hang on 1 second, folks.
Please.
Got one more.
I don't want to make you have to come all the way back and...
Yeah,
somehow
it gives a long ways. And,
yeah.
They might bring
from
us
Tillamook?
They might bring us cheese,
no cheese?
Well, I know they call that the gate opener, and so we I'm sorry. Because I do, this is Richard Obrist. I have many hats, actually. Three dairies, wife and three sons. We all work it together. And I'm on the executive board of Tillamook County Farm Bureau. But I'm also, for 20 years, nobody's wanting to get rid of me, the president of the North Coast unit of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. So that would be about 100 dairies. That's in Tillamook and Clatsop County. And we just had a meeting in January, our annual meeting there in Tillamook. And this discussion, this topic was brought up. And then we talked for about 10 to 15 minutes on it because there was a lot of issues. So... I'm just here to say that our group would support Senate Bill 1517. And just another note, the project called the Dewar Farm, when the Nature Conservancy came in with hose and backhoes and trucks and that, I don't think they realized that that topsoil was 10 feet deep. So when the last two floods, a lot of it is washed out and into the Tillamook Bay. So it has been an it's altered other neighbors, and the Averill Farm, the Prince Farm, both told me at our meeting that they were impacted by more water. So thank you for your time.
One question.
Thank
you. Yeah. Sir, as you talked about the bill, which amendment would you prefer, the -3 amendment?
I do. I like all three. The 50, the 100 yards is really appropriate, and that would be the one that I would be, and also the cost of accepted farm and forest practices and the wetlands. And, you know, there's another word, it is called marginal land. I'm a farmer. I can take marginal land and make it real productive. So keep that in mind when you hear the word marginal, because good management can turn marginal land into very good farmland. So,
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for providing your testimony. So we're going to carry over the hearing on Senate Bill 1517, and we are going to reschedule a hearing on 1563, which is a septic bill that was scheduled for tomorrow. We're going to reschedule that because tomorrow we have to finish up this, and then we get into suction dredge mining. Another that's it for tonight. Thank you, committee members, for your willingness to stay late and accommodate schedules, and didn't anticipate this many people. So we are adjourned. People, so we are adjourned. This many